Okay, Chair will call the meeting to order, Environment and Natural Resources Policy. And with quorum, Mr. President, and Representative Benson, have you reviewed the minutes of March 12th?
I have, Mr. Chair, and they look correct to me. I'd like to move them.
Okay, Representative Benson moves the minutes of March 12th, Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee. Any questions on the minutes? There being none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Hansen, I'm going to move the House file. Got to get the right page. 1222 to be laid over for further consideration. Representative Hansen, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House file 1222 is a repealer. It's a fairly simple bill repealing a provision that was passed during the special session where the legislature got involved in prescribing conditions relating to the antler point restriction. So I am repealing that section, which then goes and gives the Department of Natural Resources the authority to set the seasons as they see fit. I believe in your packet you have a letter from the DNR that includes the most recent results from public input. And I believe there are a few testifiers for the bill.
All right, thank you very much. Questions of the members of the bill at the very outset here. There being none, Robert, Todd, Marty, and Brian, you can all come down and get ready to testify on if you've signed up. You can come up to the front, and we'll have you up there one at a time. And when you get up, you'll state your first and last name and who you represent, which apparently you're saying you're just a public citizen. Welcome to the committee. Thank you. Go ahead, sit down, introduce yourself, and go ahead with your testimony. Welcome.
Well, hi, my name is Todd Votz. I live in Preston, Minnesota, and I guess I don't really represent any particular group other than myself, but I did want to come and testify in support of the Antler Point restrictions. I have been involved, I guess, kind of on the outskirts of it to some degree over the last 3 to 5 years in the development and so forth that the DNR has been working on the Antler Point restriction regulations, and I've really seen the benefits of APR over the last 3 years in which they've been enacted. And again, you know, so I've been hunting for most of my life, and I'm really, again, not here to talk even specifically for myself, but really for the next generation of hunters, particularly my kids. My kids spend a lot of time with me when I'm out in the field. I have a 6 and 8 year old children, and when we've been out in the field the last couple of years, we've really seen some positive effects through the APRs. You know, when I was a little kid, you know, if we saw any buck, any size buck, that was a pretty monumental thing. And even at that time, you know, any buck that you saw, that was one that was a harvestable buck. Today's world is quite a bit different than it was back then. You know, we have a lot of deer out in the field. But through the mentality that was kind of developed in the 70s and 80s where, you know, you shoot the first buck that you saw, that was really skewing the deer population, and it you know, harvested a lot of the young deer. And when you look at the populations in states around us, we're really kind of missing out on the potential that the state of Minnesota could have. So through the APRs, you know, we protected the 1.5 year old bucks, and then once we got in year 2 in 2011, year 3 in 2012, we really started to see a lot more, and not what we would call the trophy bucks, which a lot of people try to signify this as, but a lot of more mature bucks in the population. And for me and my kids, that was just really exciting to be in the field, be able to see a large array of age structure within bucks. We had a lot of bucks in up close that were not legal to shoot. It really taught my kids a lot about assessing the target that they're looking at, counting points on the deer, seeing how if it had, you know, 3 points on one side, 4 points on one side. You know, we went through most of the season this last year, passed up several bucks, and then we finally had a legal buck come by right at the end. And to me, that was just a really great thing that we were able to do that. And could we have done that without the APRs? You know, yes, we could, but we would not have been able to have seen the nice age structure that we did out in the field today, because in the past, if we would have let it go, it probably would have went to the neighbor's farm and then harvested at that point. So with the APRs, it really helps to protect those yearling bucks, and in at least in my eyes, really helps the younger hunters out there get more excited about the deer that we have out in the field and really be able to enjoy that out there. You know, there's a lot of different arguments for and against the APR, but again, as mentioned, I think you received the summary from the DNR here in the last couple of days, and the hunting public is in favor of keeping APRs, and it was a pretty resounding majority. So I think, you know, to keep the progressive deer management moving forward, we need to, you know, follow what the hunting public is desiring in this part of the state. So, you know, I hope that we can follow through with what the public is looking for, and move to keep the APRs enacted in southeast Minnesota.
Any questions of Mr. Vaught from the committee? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Marty Stubstead from Rochester, Minnesota. I have been in the retail sporting goods business for 36 years, a member of the Bluffland Whitetail Association for 13 years, and also a board of directors with the Bluffland for 6 years. What we need to understand here today is that over 10 years of research with tremendous amount of hours given in implementing an alternative management program for whitetail deer in southeastern Minnesota. A few years ago, Bluffland Whitetails hosted the first of its kind whitetail roundtable seminar in Rochester. Those that attended were the whitetail biologists from Pennsylvania, Missouri, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota. Hunting associations throughout the state also attended. This meeting was an exceptional opportunity for interested parties to hear and discuss whitetail management programs. This roundtable was our first hand in listening to Missouri's program using the APR system. Our Minnesota program was modeled from that, and we have mirrored the same results over the last 3 years. In numerous board meetings, it was discussed on how to implement and approach a new whitetail management program. It was a unanimous decision to work with Lou Cornicelli from the Minnesota DNR. It is their job, with their professional background and expertise, a program in whitetail management can be successfully developed. The DNR's public survey showed 64% of the southeastern Minnesota deer hunters vastly favored the antler point restrictions that has been set in effect for the last three hunting seasons. The deer hunters are also overwhelmingly in favor of no cross-tagging of antler bucks. Being that the vast majority of southeastern Minnesota hunters favor this new management program, it shouldn't be of any question to let big game management professionals of our Minnesota DNR be in control and continue forward. The opposition's biggest concern is not being able to identify their target before pulling the trigger. Sadly, this argument defies one of the top commandments in hunter safety: identify your target before you shoot. It's only common sense. The days of blasting away are over. Most all animals we hunt today have to be identified in some manner before we shoot. Turkeys, tom or hens, got a beard, pheasants, ducks, and even with the fish we catch today. Antler point restrictions identification is also in many western states for elk, mule deer, and sheep. Our DNR enforcement has already made public statements that there are not finding piles of dead deer left to lay because of the restrictions. We have great deer hunters in southeastern Minnesota that are patiently waiting for the sure target and ethical shot. Parents have also made many comments that they feel it is more safe for the family during the firearm season. Hunters have ceased in taking that running or low-light shot opportunity. The hunter enthusiasm has skyrocketed in southeastern Minnesota, especially last year after the 3 years of the APR, because they're now seeing an older class of white-tailed deer in the woods. To keep hunter retention is difficult today with all the busy schedules we keep. Even though the buck harvest had declined as it was planned the first year, 2.5-year-older bucks are being taken instead of that small young buck. The southeastern Minnesota hunters are encouraged and excited because they now know that passing up that year-old buck will give them something to be more proud of and extra meat on the table. I sincerely ask you to give the authority back to the Minnesota DNR and let them move forward with what the vast majority of the hunters want in southeastern Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of the testifiers? Being none, thank you very much. Next person, please. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Brian Todd. I reside in St. Charles, Minnesota, which would be right outside and partially in the 344 Whitewater management area. I've been hunting for about 41 years, and with my dad, who was 74 years old, he happened to take the biggest buck of his career this fall, and it's directly because of the APR situation. The deer was a 3.5-year-old deer, and he was able to survive through the years to get to that point. I hunted with my daughter, who was 10. It was her first season this year. We put in 10 days out in the field. She was able to see a couple smaller bucks during the 3B season, which is pretty much was unheard of a few years ago because they're all harvested in the 3A. She did take a nice doe at the end. I was very proud of her, and I think we got her hooked for the deer hunting. I have a son who this year found his first deer antler, which was also directly because of the APR rule. It was a little 3-point shed that was found on state ground, which again, this deer would not have been able to have a chance to make it that far, being the public pressure is on the state ground so much that the deer herd really gets hit hard. Everything I hear in zone 344 is positive for the APRs. We're seeing deer. We hunt in a big group during the muzzleloader season. We're seeing just about 3-to-1 ratio for does versus bucks during the muzzleloader season that have survived. We got neighbors at this time of the year yet comparing trail cam pictures of bucks that they're seeing yet that have made it through, and you know that everybody's kind of working together more than I've ever seen before. So in my opinion, this needs to continue, and I hope we do the right thing and give it back to control of DNR. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions of the testifier? Being none? We're going to take a vote on this bill likely in about 6 or 7 minutes. So if you can, we're going to lay the bill over. I'm sorry. So we've heard a lot about the herds and things like that. So if you have something additional to add, would we appreciate it if you'd add it?
My name is Robert Marg. I represent Winona County Farm Bureau, plus hunters in, or farmers mostly, but most of them that hunt in Wabasha County and Houston County. I've had numerous calls, and unlike your other testifiers, I am completely opposed to this. We are actually offering an alternative, which would be that the DNR must do this on a voluntary basis. Use education instead of forcing it down the throats of everybody. The other thing is I represented Southeast Minnesota for Farm Bureau at the 2005 deer meetings they had in Rochester. At that meeting, they, after going through, the hunters all wanted more deer. The thing is, the DNR themselves stated that southern Winona County and most of Houston County and a part of Filmer County were running at 45 deer per square mile. They stated 12 to 15 is what it should be, 15 as a maximum, because they said if you have more than that, they damage the woods. They say nothing about what they do to our crops. Under this antler point restriction, I went to the first meeting they had in Winona. And before it, I had called Lou Cornicelli, and he told me under it there were 3% more deer shot. He comes to the meeting, says there's 3% less deer shot. Well, then I tried to talk to him after the meeting. At 20 yards away, he was pointing his finger at me and telling me he's not talking to me, that I should talk to somebody local. So I talked to Don Ramston for 2.5 hours at my kitchen table. When I brought up antler point restrictions, the first thing he said is that's Lou Cornicelli's game, and all it is catering to the trophy hunters. That was his comment. He also said about the deer numbers, and he said, well, we don't go by those counts anymore. We go by the tolerant level of the farmers. Well, the one area where I can find information on deer counts was the chronic wasting area, in which I worked the Farm Bureau booth at the State Fair. I had farmers from that area that came in and were complaining about how much deer damage. What did they get from the DNR? Oh, there's not that many deer in that area. Funny thing is, the next year it came up as the chronic wasting area. Then they gave a count, 6,500 deer in 100 square miles. That's 65 deer per square mile. There should have been 5,000 deer shot out of that area alone to bring it down to their maximum. Now, the DNR, again, had a deprivation meeting a year ago in Winona. At that meeting, Don Nelson stated that we underestimated the number of deer in the area. We should have given more license out. Well, they didn't. Now, this year, I've got farmers, and they're in an area where the DNR says you can only take one deer. I got Bruce Speltz with $25,000 damage to his crops. I got Keith Speltz with $15,000. Tom Tieber with $15,000. There's a Leonard's, and I forget his first name. He said he has $10,000 to $15,000. Frank Kreidemacher at $10,000 to $15,000. I had about 15 names. That was from an area where they only allow you to shoot one deer. And they say we should get deprivation tags. I tried to get deprivation tags on my farm. I called the deprivation officer up, and he told me that he was getting 5 to 6 phone calls a day, and he could only get to 2 to 3 people a day. He asked me if I had extreme damage. I says, no. He says, well, I'll get to you later. He never showed up. I asked for 2 doe tags for about $1,200 damage, and he says, no, I can't do that. I wanted them for the hunting season so my hunters could shoot a couple extra does to bring the population down a little. 2 licenses. Keith Speltz, who had $15,000 damage, asked him 2 weeks before the hunting started if he could get 10 tags for either before or during. He said, no, I can't do that. You're too close to the hunting season now. Well, when we got to the meeting, the last meeting that they had in Winona now, then Lou Cornicelli there and this Clint, who was the deprivation officer, were talking. And Clint says, well, I can give tags out during the hunting season. I says, well, you wouldn't give them to me. He says, well, you didn't have me come up to your farm. I says, well, Keith Speltz had you come up, and you said there's a lot of deer damage, but you wouldn't give them to him. He turned around and walked away. At the meeting also, we had Lou Cornicelli, who I asked the question, what is the doe kill doing during this APR? He wouldn't answer the question. All he'd say is, well, we believe the whole deer population is going down. Don Nelson was standing there, and I watched him. As Lou Cornicelli was telling us that, his eyes went to the floor and his head went down, which tells me loud and clear that he knew Lou Cornicelli was lying. Now, the next question that was asked of him that he wouldn't answer was one question on the questionnaire.
Well, sir, I get the idea that you're against this, and you've given a lot of testimony. So if you could come to an end on this, I appreciate it. We're not going to tolerate accusing people of something like lying.
Well, he come up to a question that was on the questionnaire. To landowners that stated, do you want to be paid for damages? They asked, you know, what about us getting paid for damages? He didn't say anything about it. He says, there's a question over there. Another person asked, oh, there's a question over there. He sent the guy away. He wouldn't even answer the question. Now, if farmers are supposed to take that much damage on a program like this that makes it harder to shoot deer, I've got friends here that we cannot focus on the points when they're moving in the woods. And as far as knowing their target, I know it's a deer. I mean, but to move through the brush, we don't have wide open spaces. We're on hillsides with a lot of brush. And I think it's time for this to be an optional program. If that many people want it, the farmers want it, they can put it in on their farms. The deer hunters want it, they can hunt that way. But we should have all the hunters we can here. And the DNR doesn't seem to care. There's got to be some balance here.
All right, thank you very much. Representative Cornish, you have a question?
No, a comment, if I could.
Okay, go ahead with your comment.
The short comment, Mr. Chair, I agree with everything this testifier said, except the part where he got into the little name-calling thing, but I don't like this APR at all. I hope this cancer stays where it's at. I'm not going to fight that if they want to keep it down there, but I just don't want it to spread to the rest of the state. We're suffering hunter recruitment right now with young people, and the last thing I want to do is make them go out there and be unsuccessful for their first and second year while they stare at horns. And I don't like the argument that says we know what we're shooting at if we have APR. If you don't know what you're shooting at, you shouldn't be in the woods. So I don't mind taking the extra time. It's the same thing as canvasback ducks flying by at 60 miles an hour, and you got about 3 seconds to identify them or not. So I just strongly against this. If they want to keep it in that area, I'm just worried about it spreading to the rest of the state. So that's it for me.
Thank you very much.
Can I have one more comment?
No, thank you. Further testifiers, anyone else? Yes, sir. Come down.
My name is Ted Wozniak. I'm with the Minnesota Whitetail Alliance, and I'll keep it short. I do have an education in wildlife biology, and I do want to say that what the previous gentleman was talking about, that is completely independent of APR. In fact, APR is something that you can actually use to reduce deer populations. So regardless of the deer numbers, that's something that can be managed separately, but APR generally reduces deer numbers. The other thing I'll say really quick, I do run a Facebook page when we're talking about youth recruitment and retention, and it's the Minnesota Whitetail Alliance, and if you look at our the people who support us, over 50% of them are 24 years and younger. So if you're looking at hunter retention and hunter recruitment, this is the way to do it. I believe the youth are our biggest supporters. It's no doubt about it. So that's all.
Thank you very much. Questions of the testifier? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wozniak, just one question. You said that APR actually increases the deer population.
Decreases.
That's what I said, increases. What is the science? Did I say
decrease?
Go ahead, Representative Fabian.
Thank you.
It's on the tape.
Yeah, I know that. Okay. I apologize. What's the science behind that?
If you are having to pass on bucks, you're more likely to take a lot of people will shoot the first deer that comes out. And if they shoot a buck, in fact, there's a lot of people that will, if there's a doe and a six-point buck out there, they're going to take the six-point buck because it has horns. Well, if they're forced to take that doe, they're more likely to reduce the deer numbers.
And Fabian, follow up? Any other further questions? Thank you. Anyone else like to testify for or against the bill? There being none, Representative Falk, you weren't getting up, were you, to testify for or against the bill? Apparently not. Okay, so Chair will renew his motion to lay the bill over for further consideration. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Falk. You mean they're more important than us? Representative Isaacson.
Oh, thank you. Great.
Representative Isaacson moves House File 1091 for further consideration. Representative Isaacson, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Did you move? I didn't catch that. I was sent up. Is it moved already?
The bill has been moved, and okay. Now we're ready to take up the 1091A1 amendment. Would you like to move that, Representative Isaacson?
Sure.
Okay. Representative Isaacson moves the 1091A1 amendment for consideration to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails to 1091 as amended. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. This is the Aquatic Invasive Species Bill from the DNR. It's an agency bill. I'm going to have a testifier on that.
Welcome. State your name and who you represent, and go ahead with your testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, Representative Isaacson.
I am Ann Pierce with the Department of Natural Resources. I am the Invasive Species Unit Supervisor. And I will present the 1091 bill. The first section, there is an addition of decontaminates in that section. And what this will do is add decontamination to the Lake Service Provider training, allowing us to meet the demands that we're being faced with, and also to assure the public that people have been trained in decontaminate. Section 2 is the section requires that nets will be cleaned before being placed into. It is replacing when removed from. This allows nets to be cleaned more appropriately and more thoroughly at a proper location. Section 3, the phrase, unless specifically authorized under a license or permit issued by the commissioner, is added to the transportation of aquatic macrophytes. This permitting authority is outlined under Section 8, and I'll address that in a second. It will allow us to take out two of the exemptions under that subdivision, exceptions 2 and 7, which will then be conditions will be covered in the permit. Section 4, the term zebra mussel will be removed and prohibitive invasive species will be used in its stead. We will be repealing the section, the definition of zebra mussel also, and using prohibitive invasive species. Section 5, this section allows water taken from non-infested waters to be transported in tanker trucks and other commercial vehicles that are specifically designed to use in water hauling, with the requirement that the water is not discharged into another water body or within 100 feet of surface waters. And the conditions allow us to allow for an existing use that has very low risk. It also adds that vehicles used for firefighting and emergencies that threaten human health and safety would be exempted from the drain plug, allowing the drain plug to be in and water not released. Section 6, this is a technical clarification, and it basically adds individuals so that one water body that has multiple accesses can have an inspection at an individual access for that whole water body. Sections 7, 8, and 9 are additions of permitting authority by the commissioner and also allowing the commissioner to add conditions to existing permits. This will allow us to reduce the need for multiple permits and to add conditions that address the activities in Section 2, 3, and 5. Section 10 is another technical clarification. And this basically makes the licensed peace officer cannot issue both a civil citation and a criminal citation. And this is similar to what already is allowed by our conservation officers. Section 11 and 12, in these two sections, we are adding the requirement for an AIS prevention program education course for persons who have either a criminal or civil citation to provide them with further education and information. This is placed in 84D and authorized in 86B. And then finally on Section 13, repealer, we are repealing the definition of zebra mussel because it is redundant. Zebra mussel is a prohibitive invasive species. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions on House File 1091 as amended?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ugel.
Question of Representative Isaacson. This this is going to be effective when?
I believe upon signing, isn't it?
August 1st.
Does it have?
Effective date, July 1, 2015.
Oh, sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Can you
why so long?
That's the training.
That's just the training, or okay? So the rest of it will go into effect.
No, that isn't just the training. That's both the training and no. That let's see, it's right here. Training and training. Is there another date?
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, the two provisions that regarding the training would go into effect July 1, 2015. The rest of the bill, unless there's an appropriation added, would go into effect August 1 of this year.
Oh.
Okay.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Isaacson, on page 7, in subsection 11, subdivision 9, it says training for offenders. Tell me, what is the training course that they're going to be required to go through?
Mr. Chair, members, I am going to refer to our enforcement, Rodman Smith. You sit.
Lieutenant Colonel Smith, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lieutenant Colonel Rodman Smith, Assistant Director for Enforcement Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Representative Fabian, the training that would be, the person would be taking under Section 11 and Section 12 is the training that has already been prescribed in law for the trailer certification. So if somebody was going to have a trailer that they, this was enacted last year in law, and that training hasn't been developed yet. It's an online training class that you're going to, that an individual is going to have to take in order to transport water-related equipment on a trailer. So that the short answer is the training hasn't been developed yet, but it'll be the same as that training.
Representative Fabian.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm a little uncomfortable voting, or I'm not sure what the plan is on this bill. I don't remember what you said. You're going to lay it over? Okay. Thank you.
Well, could you put on the record what you're uncomfortable with?
Well, I'm just uncomfortable with the training course is not defined. We don't have a sample. We don't have things here. I just think that it's in the public's interest to know specifically what it would be.
Colonel Smith, anything to add to that? Okay. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Isaacson, we had been visited by some resort folks, and they mentioned they were working with DNR. I was expecting in this bill an exemption for resorters for their fellow family members on the AIS work. Is that still work forthcoming, or where are we at on that?
Representative McNamara, are you referring to the Norness bill? That bill is going to be an amendment that I'm going to put on the Game and Fish bill in government ops tonight.
Well, Mr. Chair, when this bill comes back, in case this ends up and your Game and Fish gets sideways, why don't we also get it on this at some point also?
Take that under advisement. Thank you, Representative McNamara.
Thank
you.
It'll
give us multiple attacks at it.
Thank you, Chair.
Further questions? Anyone in the audience like to testify for or against House File 1091 as amended? There being none, Representative Isaacson renews his motion to lay the bill over for further consideration. Thank you.
Thank you.
As amended. And then we need Representative Paul. Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The Chair will move House File 1185 to be recommended to pass and referred to the Environment, Natural Resources, Agricultural Finance Committee. Representative Falk, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in speaking with Ms. Taylor earlier, I have a small oral amendment, if you would be so kind to offer that. Ms. Taylor, if you are ready, online.
Ms. Taylor?
1.10, strike the words sealed bid and insert strike the words a sealed bid and insert an auction. And then on line 1.19, strike the words conducted through a sealed bid process. And the purpose of that is just to be more flexible with technology.
Okay, Ms. Taylor, can you repeat the amendment?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, the amendment would read on line 1.10, delete a sealed bid and insert an auction, and then on line 1.19, delete conducted through a sealed bid process.
A discussion on the amendment. There being none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. To the bill as amended, Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This deals with the taking of nuisance elk, and this is a kind of a rare situation to my understanding, but it has occurred in the past. And one of the things we have is basically a cost for nuisance elk in the ag budget. there's a cost for damages as a result of elk. And one of the things that just looked at exploring the option of is if we're going to go and issue permits or licenses to go and take nuisance elk, we should actually try to get as much value for that as possible. And so this would allow the or ask the commissioner to go and conduct those through a auction process and then award the bids, licenses to the highest bids. And the reason why, I mean, I have no problem with the fact that we want to have a process that allows people to fairly have access during the normal hunting seasons, but for these extraordinary circumstances where we are taking nuisance elk, if there is the opportunity there to go and collect additional revenue, which relieves our pressure on other state resources, I think that's something we should explore. I'm not sure if the department wishes to speak to the bill. I said that I'd be willing to still work with them on this, but I think this is something we need to explore.
Thank you, Representative Falk, and I see the department is coming forward to speak on House File 1185 as amended. Welcome, and introduce yourself, and let's hear the comments from the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Thielander. I'm the Wildlife Section Chief for DNR. And just want to comment from the department's perspective on this bill. Currently, we've got a program in place to deal with elk damage by having some various options, long-term or short-term options. If we have a depredation complaint, we've got available for long-term food plots strategically located to try to reduce damage to private lands, stored forage management. If there's depredation problems in the wintertime, to say stored forage or hay, we can protect that with fencing, work with landowners in that regard. And then some immediate options, landowner shooting permits deal with depredation problems in summer croplands on the spot. We usually turn those permits around within a day of request. And then also we have in statute currently to use licensed hunters to take nuisance elk between August 15 and March 1. Some of the concerns we have with the bill as drafted is transferring the funding to the general fund would be a version of revenue under our federal aid language. That's a big concern. So that would not be allowed by the Fish and Wildlife Service Wildlife Restoration Program. We'd jeopardize all of our federal aid, which amounts to about $15 million annually. Also, by issuing license through an auction process would remove our long-standing practice of allowing equal opportunity to all people interested in license purchase. And then lastly, it would result in a longer response time for depredation complaints, and that would be met with resistance from landowners. We need to be responsive and timely in our response to depredation concerns. So I guess just in summary, I would say that we're concerned about jeopardizing federal aid projects. We're concerned about this would not minimize our interaction with landowners, but would tend to increase conflicts that would reduce it, and then also it would not make license available to those folks, except those can afford to pay the bid up prices. So, thank you.
So I take it from your testimony the department opposes the bill.
We are opposed to the bill.
Thank you. Questions for the testifier, Representative Falk? There being none, people in the audience would like to testify for or against the bill. Okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Falk and Deputy Commissioner Thielander, excuse me, your definition of nuisance elk.
Representative Falk.
I would defer to the department to, I mean, I don't have the statute book in front of me, but.
Mr.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian. Definition of nuisance elk would be those elk that are actively causing damage to croplands or stored forage.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how do you determine that as an agency? When the complaint is registered?
Yeah, we get a complaint at our area office, and we go out and respond to the complaint, visit with the landowner, inspect the damage.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And generally speaking, how long does that process take?
Well, we normally respond to those a day of the complaint. If we get a call in the morning, we'll be out there that day to inspect and confer with the landowner.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Falk, I've talked to him about this. My concern with the process here is that there's going to be a substantial waiting period before we actually deal with the nuisance elk, and we have a history of how some of them get dealt with, and I really don't want that to happen in the future. So, thank you.
Yeah. Further questions of Representative Falk or the department? There does not appear to be anyone to testify for or against the bill one last time. There being none, Representative Faulk renews his the chair renews his motion that House File 1185 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Natural Resources and Agricultural Committee. I said that as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Aye. Motion prevails.
Division.
Division has been called. Those for the bill, raise their hand. Those against. There being eight yes and seven no, the bill does prevail.
Good ears, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right, I'm going to lay out a little groundwork here on House File 906. We're going to have a delete all amendment from Representative Hansen when he gets up to the table. Representative Hansen, you want to come up? And we're going to have the DE3 amendment. We're first going to move the bill before us, House File 906, and the motion will be that Representative Hansen moves House File 906 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Government Operations Committee. And so then we are going to take up the DE3. So Representative Hansen makes that motion as well as the motion to move House File 906 DE3 amendment to get the bill into the shape that the author would like the bill. Any discussion on those items? There being none, in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. So now, members, we're working off of the DE3 amendment, and for the audience, you will have this as a bill now rather than the numbered bill that was over in the, and I assume that there are copies of the DE3 over on the table if you don't have them already. Representative Hansen to the DE, I'm sorry, to the House File 906 as amended. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hackbar.
Mr. Chairman. I was under the assumption that we're going to take this bill up after session.
Well, that is correct.
And with that, Mr. Chairman, that's what I was told, and I had relayed that information to a number of other folks that are now no longer here because they're going to come back after session to hear this bill.
We have an hour and 5 minutes to go move forward to this bill, and so that's a good point. I should have included that in the groundwork. We're going to start working through the testifiers. There have been even more sign up than had originally signed up. We've got the bill before us as amended. We are going to recess at 6 o'clock or thereabouts.
Well, and then Mr. we are Chairman, going to come our back. Our caucus has a caucus at 5:30.
Okay, we can recess at 5:30 before session. But we're going to get started on the bill, and then we're going to come back, and anyone else who wants to testify on the bill or anybody that isn't listed and wants to testify on the bill will be allowed to do that when we come back after session. It's supposed to be a short session, and that will provide everyone an opportunity to participate in the debate.
Well, Mr. Chairman, first of all, I was under the assumption that we were coming back on this bill after session, and then I was also going to have a comment that not only is this committee meeting after session, also the Environment Committee is meeting after session, and there's people on this committee that are on that committee, etc. So I there's some conflicts going on here, and I understand the predicament you're in, but you know, I was told that we weren't coming back until after session on this bill. I just I'm a little dismayed by what's going on here.
Well, Representative Hackbarth, everyone will get an opportunity to testify for or against the bill, and all amendments that are being presented here tonight will be taken under consideration before we either pass or fail the bill out of this committee. And I did not anticipate, frankly, that we would be moving through the bills as quickly as we are. And in the interest of time, Representative Hackbarth, I have the Game and Fish bill as well, and the DNR technical bill up in another committee. So everyone is struggling right now with the. So we have the choice. We can take 30 minutes. We can take a brief listen to the bill from Representative Hansen. We can listen to the testifiers in the next 35 minutes, or we can just recess right now. That's not my choice. We're going to go ahead, get a brief test, and then once we hear the testifiers on the bill, we'll be able to have a robust discussion on the amendments and the bill as it gets done. So, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Just one moment, Representative Hansen. I did tell Representative Hackbarth that we were going to take the bill up after 6 o'clock. I did that, but I was not. I thought, frankly, that the antler point thing would be a lot more than 4 or 5 testifiers and some other things as well. So, anyway, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And I appreciate your explanation. I want to just kind of repeat that for members in the audience that we are now working off the DE3 amendment. The DE3 amendment is based on input that I have received from agencies and a wide variety of sources since the bill was introduced. And so it starts out with Section 1 with a number of definitions, defining local unit of government, defining mining, processing, and silica sand project, temporary storage, transporting. And then on page 2, it has standards and criteria by October 1st, 2013, the Environmental Quality Board, in consultation with local units of government, shall develop model standards and criteria for mining, processing, and transporting of silica sand. These standards and criteria may be used by local units of government in developing local ordinances. Then we have a listing of standards and criteria all through page 2. On page 3, you have silica sand technical assistance team. By October 1st, 2013, the Environmental Quality Board shall assemble a silica sand technical assistance team to provide local units of government with assistance in ordinance development, zoning, environmental review and permitting, and other issues arising from silica sand mining and processing operations. I have modeled this off from the wetland technical evaluation panels. The technical assistance team shall be comprised of up to 7 members that can be chosen from the following agencies and entities. And the majority of the members must be from a state agency and have expertise in one or more following issues. I have added subdivision 4 that, frankly, I have taken from Representative Kelly's bill that was similar to my bill and has similar to the technical evaluation panels for wetland, the local government must consider the findings or recommendations in its approval or denial of the project, and then give reasons for the disagreement. The effective date is the following enactment. Rules, section 2. I received from the Pollution Control Agency copies of rules from the Wisconsin agencies that affect both reclamation and air quality. Minnesota does not have similar rules, so I'm directing the Pollution Control Agency to adopt rules to incorporate those relevant standards into Minnesota rules. And then Section 3 is an appropriation to make sure that this is funded. And that, Mr. Chair, is the bill.
Okay, we'll take 3 questions if there are any for members, just if there are any top-level. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, could you just tell me kind of at a high level what are the differences still between your bill now in its current form and Representative Kelly, because this is the first time we've seen your new DE3.
Well, Mr. Chair, and Representative McNamara, Representative Kelly's bill was essentially a modeled on my bill, and the primary difference is that my bill has the Environmental Quality Board who will be involved, and Representative Kelly's bill sets up a new level of government to handle those processes.
Further questions? Okay, well, Representative Buechel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, under the rules, you said that we're going to incorporate some of the Wisconsin Administrative Code. As far as that goes, the Pollution Control Agency shall adopt the rules to incorporate Wisconsin Administrative Code pertaining to non-metallic mining. Just how long have those rules been in effect in Wisconsin, and how effective have they been?
Representative Madison.
Mr. Chair and Representative Uglum, I do not have that information in front of me. I can provide that when we come back after session.
Thank you. That'd be very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to take the first testifier, Amanda Griggs. If you want to come forward. Ms. Griggs, introduce yourself to who you represent.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Amanda Griggs. I am a resident of the most diverse ecosystem in the state, Houston County of the Driftless Region. I have come before you today to express concerns relating to non-metallic mining of industrial silica sand and its adverse effects on the environment. At this time, Wisconsin is struggling to control this industry. Even with the DNR stretched thin, they have still found 80 to 90% non-compliance, including two significant runoff incidences of toxic water. These disasters to drinking water do not need to happen. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I respectfully urge your support for the EQB standards. The Driftless Region's cold water trout streams are a sign of ecological health. According to DNR plant ecologist Ann Pierce, who was sitting up here earlier, quote, this ecoregion comprises 3% of Minnesota's land area, but provides habitat for 43% of the state's listed plant and animal species. Without strong state regulations, their habitats will be destroyed. The DNR has an extensive aggregate mapping program. What about the hydrological mapping? They are yet to be completed. How can we allow mining permits without understanding the hydrology of the area? And what about our air? There are no exposure standards for the known carcinogen silica dust. Our air will be filled with diesel exhaust, also a toxic element that causes autism in children that are born and unborn. These dangers must be fully understood before mining takes place in our communities. High-quality rivers and trout streams of the Driftless Region are recognized on state and national levels for their economic and environmental importance. The tourism industry generates $11.2 billion, including $694 million in sales tax, and accounts for close to 250,000 jobs. I believe we must protect this industry. My final point is the increasing concern of climate change. In 2007, the Minnesota legislature set goals to reduce our emissions 15% by 2015. Excessive diesel exhaust, change in land use, and exposure of our water is a setback. When do we draw the line? Do we continue to allow our precious ecosystems to be destroyed to support yet another system that shatters our national environment? I ask you all, please take a stand today. I thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for having a hearing today and hearing our testimony on this House file, and I thank the committee and Representative Hansen.
Okay, Ms. Griggs, Representative Yaruso, at the very least, has a question for you. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to comment on something for the record. I don't dispute the bulk of the testimony, but the statement about an element causing autism is incorrect. I believe the testifier is probably referring to mercury, and the papers that linked that with autism were falsified. They've been rejected from the original British medical journals in which they were published, and the author of them has been censored by his colleagues.
Thank you, Representative Russo. Any further questions of the testifier? Representative Uglum.
Yes, just one other question. You mentioned that there were no known standards for exposure to silica dust. Where did you get that information, ma'am?
Greg.
Mr. Chair. Representative, I have been studying this issue for over a year, and as far as there are standards for indoor industry, but as far as exposure into the open air, there are no standards at this point. And I've been studying this and calling the MPCA and all of our agencies and have not found a good answer on this.
Mr. Chair, but in fact, those standards for indoor exposure are based on parts per million in the air, and obviously inside they could be more concentrated and changed through air makeup systems and things like that, where on outside it can still be measured at the point of the exposure and everything else. And OSHA, in fact, and I used to deal with this, OSHA, in fact, does control the exposure of silica and crystalline silica dust with workers in many, many industries. Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Ms. Craig.
Thank you. I do have to say that the levels at which they are measuring them at this time does not, I believe, adequately address silicosis and the damage that can be done by the size. It's the micron size that we need to look at and have stricter standards. So thank you.
Representative Isaacs here?
Nope.
Okay. Someone here from the PCA that can address this specific question? Welcome, Mr. Thornton.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner to the PCA. We have no standards that apply specifically to these kinds of facilities. We have no silica sand standards for ambient air quality conditions. We've asked the Health Department to develop a health-based value that we can use. It's short of a standard, but it's a formal process that they go through where they look at all the literature and make recommendations to us for safe levels in the air, and they're in the process of doing that. I'm not exactly sure what the time frame is for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that you may not, but OSHA does under the Hazard Communication Standard and the Crystalline Silica Standard. Which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Mr. Chairman, OSHA does have, as I understand it, exposure standards for people that work in industrial situations. I don't think it's just for indoors. I think it's just within factory environments. And I'm sorry, I don't know what that number is right now.
Correct. I, Mr. Chair, I don't know the exposure limits either or the de minimis concentrations, but it is controlled and regulated under OSHA.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my understanding, though, is the exposure rates you're concerned about here aren't the work site. You're concerned about the neighborhoods and the surrounding area, correct? So what you're saying is there aren't standards developed for a locale or a city or a rounding area that is in the area of one of those mines, not specifically to the mine itself. So the general population standards is what we're really talking about here.
Ms. Gregg.
Mr. Chair, thank you. This industry is very large, and for example, there are a lot of transload facilities proposed and getting started in Winona County. Mm-hmm. Also, the potential for piles of sand to be at an open pit and blowing across the landscape, depending on the wind, the direction, the strength. These dust particles you cannot see. So it's something that is not well tested, studied, or understood, and mm-hmm. it is carcinogenic.
And so I want to just point out that while I'm sure that OSHA has standards for this sort of thing, it's in an occupational safety situation, whereas what she's referring to is a general situation like a home, a residence, an environment, a city, which is entirely different. Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if Commissioner Thornton could come back. Commissioner Thornton, I've just got a question. Do you have the ability to grant permits subject to evaluation, and if you were to come up with a standard in the future, would you be able to make those permits conditional on a standard yet to be determined?
Mr. Garten.
Mr. Chairman, I'm thinking. What we would probably do in a situation like that is reopen a permit and put new conditions in once a standard was in place.
And McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Thornton, so an industrial person or entity wanting to get a permit could agree with MPCA that the permit be subject to air monitoring, and that future air monitoring may subject them to some controls yet to be determined?
Mr. Chairman, Martin. Representative McNamara, that's correct.
Thank you.
Further questions for testifier Griggs? Oh, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you for Commissioner Thornton. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I know in the area in which I live, in the metro area, there are air monitors that are permanent. And so we have a reasonable basis, not good enough in my judgment, but a basis for knowing what the base is. Do we have any kind of baseline monitoring in these areas which are have the potential to be mined for frac sand?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wiginius, actually we don't. The last two permits that we've issued, we have put in monitoring requirements. And one of those facilities is the equipment is in place and they're beginning to collect the data now. And Wisconsin, some of the industry in the Eau Claire area has on their own put in some monitors, and some of that information is just coming in. So we really don't have a base of data out there yet. And that's one of the gaps here in this issue.
Thank you. Representative Clark has a bill in, I understand, for a mobile unit to do some air quality monitoring. Would that kind of mobile unit be useful in getting some baseline air quality testing in these areas where there's potential for this mining?
Mr. Thornton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wiginius, we've taken a good look at that bill, and our recommendation would not be to go with a mobile monitoring device. Our recommendation, if there's an interest in getting additional monitoring data, to put in fixed monitors. They can be moved after a period of time, but they give us an ability to compare completely the data that we're collecting to the rest of our monitoring network and what's being done around the country.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Wiginius.
Thank you. Well, if that is not your recommendation, and I thought, if I remember correctly, that was about $400,000, maybe way off. Can you, in a reasonable amount of time, do air quality monitoring so that there is a baseline in these areas that are under discussion?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Wiginius, given the resources, we can do monitoring, and or we can make it happen, whether it's our work that we do or requiring someone else to do it and monitoring what they do.
Representative Wiginius.
Well, let's talk about the resources then. What do you mean by that? I mean, you're talking about cash, I can tell, but what do you mean by that?
We're drifting very closely into the Environment Finance Committee, and that's where this bill will end up going. But go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wiginius. Well, it would not be just money. There, we would need probably at least part of an FTE. I believe it's going to be in the order of a few hundred thousand dollars. I don't have the number in front of me, but it's less than half a million.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Ms. Griggs. James McAlvath. And then the next person will be Lynn Schoen. Welcome to the committee. State your name and address, or state your name and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and committee members. My name is Jim McElrath, and I'm a Florence Township Board Supervisor in Goodhue County, and live in the city of Frontenac. A Florence Township Board has enacted a one-year moratorium last year to get our zoning ordinances and comprehensive plans in line and updated because of the new event of a silica frac sand mining. We have nearly completed our work through our efforts, and we realize that we still need some state-level help. Our townships and counties are not up to other townships and counties are not up to date with their ordinances. Some of them don't even have a comprehensive plan. And due to the immense size of the frac sand industry, their activities cross state lines, city lines, towns, and townships. With our ordinances in line and theirs not in line, the immense traffic will flow through our town and townships, causing hazardous conditions for our residents. In Florence Township, we hit the pause button to deal with the frac sand mining issues and concerns, and we're asking the state to do the same and have a study conducted to establish statewide standards. And after the last testimony, it's pretty obvious to me that those really don't really exist in any kind of solid fashion. The history and behavior of the frac sand mining companies have been devastating in western Wisconsin. And it's already happening in Winona and Wabasha. And we predict that it will go through southeastern Minnesota like a juggernaut unless we take call time out to study the issues. Without action, we'll wake up one morning and look in the mirror and say, what the hell happened? It's how fast they move. Whether you're Republicans or Democrats, we're all Minnesotans, and as a local government, we're asking the state to step up the plate because we need your help. Thank you.
Go ahead.
My name is Lynn Shane. I'm a councilperson on Wabasha City. I represent the city for now. Our town consists of a lot of small businesses. Many of them are dependent on the tourism industry. Where we are located, it's at an interstate bridge and a two-lane highway, Highway 61, and then we've got the rail yard there. We keep hearing at testimonies about these great high-paying jobs that are supposed to be coming our direction, but when you look at where our hospital and clinic sits and the way that people have to come across the bridge to come use our dentists, our retailers, our everything else, we're looking, one of our concerns is that people aren't going to come to our town. Our town is only 2,500, but our drawing area is 10,000. When you clog up the bridge, you clog up the highway, with the number of trucks we're talking about high-paying jobs having to be laid off. We've got assistants, dental hygienists, nurses, doctors that are not going to have the patient base that they're going to need. In all of the testimony I've sat through for the last couple of weeks, there are still questions people can't answer, and that's what I'm here to just, you know, if you can answer this at the end of everything is said and done, great. But right now, nobody's been able to provide answers. One is the acceptable particulate matter size and volume before the air does become an issue for silicosis. We don't have ambient air quality measurements. You just heard that. Second is, how much silica sand can we lose from our aquifer before it starts really affecting our water levels? We're in a drought in southern Minnesota. A lot of the water is stored in the sand system that acts as our filter. My question is, how much sand can you take and still guarantee our water supply? Thirdly, how much traffic can a neighborhood tolerate in terms of diesel emissions? This transload facility that I'm talking about that exists in Wabasha is situated right in the middle of the neighborhood, and we already, as a town, rank in the top 15% for the state for diesel emissions. We're in a river valley that makes this especially critical issue for breathing concerns such as asthma. Four, who is going to monitor and then hold accountable the businesses that are non-compliant? We just heard that over in Wisconsin, DNR said in an article in the La Crosse paper that between 80 and 90% of the silica sand businesses are non-compliant. Many of those vendors are from Minnesota. Who's going to monitor them? Who's going to hold them compliant? You know, we don't have a training program for our police departments. We don't have any direction in our small town about how do we hold them compliant and what is our recourse. We need more information on that. And five, how many people will choose not to do business or vacations in Wabasha because they don't want to deal with the noise and traffic? And then how many small businesses will be collateral damaged because of that decline? As I said, we are tourism-based. We have a lot of, you know, B&Bs, outdoor canoe rentals, lots of restaurants, that kind of thing. In Wabasha County alone, which is a very small county, we have 650 jobs just for tourism. And six, how much revenue is the state prepared to lose because of loss of our property values? And the second question to that is, how do you plan to make up that lost income? Why would we like to see an extensive environmental study to address some of the above questions? Because no one has answers to these yet. There isn't a standard this is not a standard metallic mining business like the agriculture companies will come up here and tell you to believe. This is a non-metallic mining issue. Someone has to ultimately be responsible to monitor and enforce these businesses. We must have a state permitting process in addition to our local conditional use permits, so this is looked at in a comprehensive manner. It's going to take a statewide moratorium so we have enough time to establish this permitting process. The scope and magnitude of the silica sand mining and transport businesses demand that we get this right. Why are you in such a hurry? Let's slow it down. Thank you.
Any questions? Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself, please.
Hi, I'm Jody McElrath, and I think my name was on the same line as James McElrath, so I'm here to testify, hoping that I wasn't bypassed. I'm from Florence Township. I'm a planning commissioner, and I'm also the chair of Save the Bluffs, a citizens group. So thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I want to first thank Representative Hansen for introducing the bill. It's very important as a step in obtaining our much-needed help from the state for the silica frac sand mining. We must work together to strengthen this bill to accomplish the required controls on this potentially invasive and uncontrolled industry. I'd like to call your attention to a four-page handout that I asked to be put into your packets today. It's full of facts. A lot of studies have already been completed. There's a lot of facts already on frac sand issues, and these would help to expedite the effort and timeline of the studies that we're asking for. We also need, in addition to that, some time out. Let's try not to allow new permitting on those mines that may be asking for permitting during this time where a study can be completed. And that way we can get our standards as we've been asking for, and local governments just don't have the resources to establish those standards. We need them at the state level. The sand companies will have many arguments against our requests. They argue that adequate standards and regulations are already in place. It's important to note that most of those standards and regulations were intended for construction sand, aggregate sand mining, processing, and transport. This is a very, very different business. The mining companies will also claim that the air quality standards are in place. As far as I know, the PM10 is about the smallest micron size that is being evaluated right now. It's the 3 to 2.5 micron size that is the invisible threat. They'll also argue that they provide jobs. The fact is, most of their jobs required skilled mining workers, most of whom are imported. At best, some trucking jobs would be the economic outcome. I also remind you to look at the handout on the socioeconomic impacts. There are many facts and figures on tourism and so on in that handout. We can't trust our current standards to a whole new industry with significantly different type of operations. I want to remind you, as Lynn did, about the several accidents, the track record of the Wisconsin mines, and there are several non-compliance issues. Let's put some teeth into this bill before frac sand mining bites us. Let's take a time out, get the studies done, and get the standards. I thank you.
Any questions? Thank you. And we're in recess. Be back about 20 minutes after session. Okay, we're going to call the meeting back to order. We're going to continue. I want, just for the people who might not have been here, because we originally said this would happen at 6 o'clock, what we've had is we've had four testifiers thus far on House File 906. But if you're just coming into the room, House File 906 at the outset of the introduction of the bill before the committee was amended with the 906DE3 amendment. And so there are copies of the DE3 amendment, and for those who aren't familiar with the process, if you have a bill that says 906 on the top of it, we're not working off of that anymore. We're working off of the amendment that was added to it, which DE means delete all. So that means the amendment is up there, the bill that we're actually working from. With that, I'd like to call Ms. Garlitz, Mr. Johnson, and Mr. Sulin up to the testifying stand. and welcome and introduce yourself, of course, as you know how to do that on House Bill 906 as amended. Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'll kick off the local government section of your agenda for tonight. We are very grateful to Representative Hansen for the work he's put into this. He's been working with us on language. Some of that is already reflected in the DE3 amendment. Ms. Garlitz will refer to that. I'm just going to talk in general about the things that local governments are watching on this issue, because as you can guess, this is a significant issue for a large number of our members in cities, towns, and counties in the state. And what it really comes down to is our folks are elected to make the best decisions for their local communities based on the circumstances, the economics, the health and public safety and welfare issues that are going on in their area. And we are working to make sure that they can do that to the best ability that they can, and that the state gives them the help they need to do that. So, one is to preserve that ability to make sure that they continue to be able to make those decisions for their constituents. The second is to make sure that the state provides as much technical and informational support for them to do those decisions well as we need to do that. And the third is just to make sure that we have the financial ability to deal with the impacts that this might have on public infrastructure and public services when these types of operations come into a community. As you can guess, we have a lot of communities that have never dealt with an issue of this size or scope before, and they're suddenly having to. So the state has an ability and a role to help them figure out how to best do that and give them the information they need, and then they can go forward and make the decisions as they normally would. And, Mr. Chair, we think that this bill is a very good move in that direction and is on track to providing that information. I'll let Ms. Garlitz go into a couple of specifics on that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. Ms. Garlitz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Anna Lee Garlitz, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And again, counties would like to echo what Mr. Johnson said. A couple of the detailed comments that we have on the bill. First of all, again, we'd like to thank Representative Hansen for adding in particular, in Subdivision 2, in consultation with local units of government. We thought that that was an important addition to have in the bill. We've talked with him about some of the more specific concerns, and we are happy to work with him, and he's indicated that he's going to keep working with us as it moves on to the next committee, and that can be addressed, and some of these are best addressed in government operations. Specifically, we'd like to talk about the setbacks, where it identifies no less than and identifies a blank number of feet. We'd like that to be removed, and we brought that up to Representative Hansen. We'd like that to be worked out, some that discussion to happen at the Environmental Quality Board and not necessarily right here in this bill. And then one other question that we do have, and we want to clarify the intent on Subdivision 4 under consideration of board recommendations. We have some questions about how this works when the Environmental Quality Board identifies their findings and how local government might work to put that in our findings. So we'd just like a little bit of clarification on this. And again, we'll be working with Representative Hansen. And I will turn it over now to Mr. Sulem from the townships.
Welcome, Mr. Sulem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. I'll be very brief, because my colleagues have covered this very well. At the end of last week, we had about 35 township officers in from southeast Minnesota, primarily Olmsted and Fillmore County, and they gave me very strict marching orders, state assistance, state expertise, no mandates. And this bill is a very good start towards getting us towards that, providing us the technical expertise that we need to make local decisions, but providing flexibility at the local level. Representative Hansen has indicated a willingness to work with us on some of the minor details. The only other thing I would add is that I was very happy to learn in conversations with some of the folks from EQB today, the additional issue that we would like to see at the township level is some of the infrastructure impact, which was more germane for the next stop of this bill. But EQB assures me that they're actually able to assist us because their connections with MnDOT to actually keep that, even though EQB will be chairing this group, to help us deal with some of the infrastructure concerns with the wear and tear on roads and bridges. So I was happy to learn that this evening. With that, I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sulem. Ms. Garlitz, for the benefit of the chair, can you repeat what you said about Subdivision 2 on the DE3, page 2? I didn't quite get all of that.
Oh, in subdivision 2, Mr. Chair, we liked the addition. This was something that was not in the initial bill, and we did talk with Representative Hansen, and he addressed our concerns by adding in the on line 2.2, adding in consultation with local units of government.
Thank you. Any questions for the three?
Mr.
Johnson.
The other subdivision 2 piece that was mentioned is on lines 2.7 through 2.17 are references to various setbacks, and it says no less than blank feet. What we are working with Representative Hansen on is we understand that you would want to have some recommendations in a model ordinance type setting for potential setbacks, but we don't want the statute that enables that study to say no less than blank feet and have that number filled in by the legislature. We would like setbacks to be one of the issues that's determined by the group that's being put together to study this issue.
So what you're hoping is that this goes into law with the blanks, and that the units of government and the EQB figure out what those numbers are to be? Is that how I'm understanding it?
Mr. Chair and members, I think we would rather just have setbacks for it. Let's just take number on line 2.12, setbacks from bluffs would be one of the issues listed. That, and if you look at line 2.5, it says the standards and criteria must include. And so the group would then determine what the appropriate setbacks from bluffs were. The legislature wouldn't put no less than blank feet and deal with it there. But that's it's a land use zoning issue, and so we think it's very appropriate that we can work on that and address it in the Government Operations Committee if needed.
Well, one of the tempting parts of this section is filling in the blank.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that does scare us mildly.
That's a pretty tempting thing, and I mean that's similar to my opinion on the DNR shoreline regulations as well, is that I think that's I'm for more local control than a mandate from the top. So, Representative Fabian, you have questions of the testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for my 2 cents worth on that, I echo their concerns about local government control. And in those setbacks, maybe we should consider some language that would be as determined by the LGUs.
Further questions? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for any of the three, I guess. Some of the language, and because I'm not probably as versed as most of you here, over in subsection 4 on page 3, subdivision, excuse me, where it starts in 3.12. And if you read that going down to 3.15, it says basically the local unit of government must consider the findings and recommendations of the board in its approval or denial of the silica sand project. And then if the local government unit does not agree to the board's findings or recommendations, detailed reasons, and basically what they're saying is you're going to be at the discretion of the board, and if you don't like what they say, you're going to be up for a fight. Are you comfortable with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, spoken like a true township officer. We appreciate that. That is one of the sections that we've had some conversations with Representative Hansen on. We'd like to have a little tweaking of that provision to make it clear. To some extent, we do this from a legal perspective. I'd be advising, you know, the township's officers, Mr. Johnson's attorneys who advise the cities, Ms. Garland's attorneys, the counties, to include similar findings in their findings of fact anyhow. But we do need a little tweaking of that language in the next committee, which is where it's germane in the zoning aspect, to clarify what is the guidance and what is preemptive, because we need to have good findings of fact stated, but we don't want to be told what has to be in those findings specifically. That does create a bit of a threshold. It's a problem. But Representative Hansen has indicated a very strong willingness to help us do some softening, and one way we could address that that we've discussed is if the local government were to ask for the assistance, then it would become the threshold, but it wouldn't be just out there as a absolute standard to begin with. It would have to be at the request of the local government.
Okay. Representative Green?
No, that was my question. Thank you.
Representative McNamara?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming you'd want to wait until after all the testifiers, but I do have an amendment that works to this question, but I'm assuming you'd rather get through all the testifiers.
Well, Representative Hansen isn't in here. He's off to other committees. Oh, is he here? Oh, you disappeared. I really would like to wait until I understand where this is going, and I tend to agree with what I've heard here, but I want to wait till we get to amendments, and then we'll do all amendments. That way, if people want to go after they've testified, they can. Because it is going to get late here, obviously. It's 10 after 8. Okay, and Representative Johnson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative of the Township Organization, when I read that language, I don't see where the fight is involved. Am I incorrect in reading it that the local government unit, if they do not agree with the board's findings, they need to justify that, basically. They need to explain it. Am I correct?
Representative Doolin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you are correct, and that's why I said the lawyer in me says we're advising our clients to do this type of thing anyhow. The question is exactly how to make it clear in the statute that it isn't creating an absolute mandate. It's giving us the clear wiggle room, but that is general advice we'd give our clients anyhow, is to make sure that your findings are very specific.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Johnson.
I'd like to follow up then with where is it that this is a I don't see in this language where this is a mandatory standard.
Representative Johnson, are you saying?
Well, I'm asking where is the mandatory standard in the language that you're suggesting?
Are you saying on line 3.15 it says unit must consider, and then later it says on 3.16 it says does not agree with the board's findings and recommendations. The detailed reasons must be in the record.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is you don't see a mandate, Mr. Sulin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the issue is exactly as Chairman Dill was indicating. It's the must consider language. And the timing of when that comes in, there's some vagueness right now in the current language as to where in the process, if we're just about finished with an application or perhaps have even finished the application and now EQB were to come in with a new finding, how does that affect what we're in the process of? And so we just need to tighten up that a little bit. We're not that far off, but it's just a little bit of tweaking.
Mr. Johnson.
And Mr. Chair and members to the same question, and I think the key word there that actually really affects timing is the word recommendations. A finding comes from EQB when a specific request is made from them for a decision, and that's we're used to dealing with findings and we're used to having to consider them in our decisions. But the word recommendations could come at any time during any process. It would just have to be EQB deciding to make a recommendation, and we would suddenly have to consider whatever that was at a higher level than any other public comments we received.
Further questions of the testifiers? There being none, we will go back now and start again with the public testimony. And a citizen, is it Kaeschler? William? Winston. Or Winston, I'm sorry. state your name for the record and then go ahead. It says public citizen, so thank you for coming. You're the most important part of this.
Thank you.
And go ahead with after your name and with your testimony.
Okay. My name is Winston Kaler. I'm a musician and music teacher from Red Wing. As such, I'm an amateur at governance, but a professional musician, and I appreciate your taking the time to hear what I have to say. When I was casting about for an idea to make it somewhat interesting, I thought, well, how about the city song? Oh, the moon shines tonight on pretty Red Wing, which Woody Guthrie took and made into, oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the Union. I couldn't do that, so I have to be satisfied with just saying that I think we're considering here an issue that has the potential for introducing dissonant and discordant elements into the economic composition of southeastern Minnesota. And obviously we don't want to do that. Nobody wants to see Wild West Williston or Western Wisconsin in southeastern Minnesota. I think that would be a pretty safe statement to make. The question is, how do we accomplish that so that mining will not be like an invasive species that saps the important resources of the area, the air, the water, cultural and historical assets of the communities there. In other words, we don't want to spend down capital just for a quick fix of income. And to maintain that delicate balance in that beautiful area, I think it is necessary that we have a general environmental impact study and that we have a moratorium enacted so that that study can have the time it needs to be properly done. After that, the state needs to take an active role in establishing realistic guidelines and controls to keep the industry from significantly or adversely affecting its host environment. I think of the taconite industry, which is going today, but could be operating under much more favorable conditions if the proper planning had been done in the first place when that industry was located on the shores of Lake Superior before anybody realized that one does not dump taconite tailings into a body like Lake Superior if you want to keep the drinking water for Duluth and the North Shore. I would also hope to address some misconceptions that I have heard at previous hearings on this issue in the Senate committee in the past few weeks. One of those being that sand mining is somehow equatable or compatible with agricultural uses. There was even a statement to the effect that farmers are used to working with dust and noise and other annoyances, and therefore they will not mind having dust and noise and annoyances from sand miners right next to them. I think we should realize that what we're talking about is a heavy industry, a large-scale industry, and more importantly, that it is dependent on getting its products to market, and right now the answer to how is that going to be done seems to be trucking on roads, which will be going through towns and through rural areas, and that it's not only the wear and tear on the roads, but it's the wear and tear on the people who live along those roads. I have a house that is one block away from a route that would be a prime sand trucking route. Secondly, I would contradict the statement that I heard that the frac sand industry is a part of the energy revolution and we have to get in on the energy revolution. Quite the contrary, I think that frac sand mining is a part of perpetuating our dependency on artificially cheap subsidized supplies of fossil fuels in an industry that is essentially controlled by interests east and southwest of the state of Minnesota. And the third issue that I would like to comment on is I've heard it said that the sand mining industry has been here for a long time, has a long history. It is locally controlled and responsible to the communities in which it is located. The industry that we're talking about is the frac sand or silica sand industry. It's an economic giant whose first allegiances necessarily have to be to investors and interests outside the boundaries of the state, and that we have to ask ourselves, is southeastern Minnesota going to be an economic colony whose resources are exploited so that profits can be exported and then the local residents will be left stuck with the bills for depleted water supplies, worn out roads, despoiled landscapes, health problems, other problems, again all for the sake of a quick fix of income. And the choices are ours. I hope that public officials here and throughout state and local government units will have the courage to make those choices now while we still can and not be enticed into a shipwreck or a train wreck by a siren song of easy money or easy income. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The next testifier is Dean Flugstad. And members, folks in the audience, I am certain that there's a lot of emotion about this issue, and it's certainly coming out in testimony, but I want to stick to the bill. We have a piece of legislation before us, and I want to stick to the items of the bill that we're discussing here to the best of our ability. So if you've reviewed the bill and you want to discuss the bill, that's fine. But talking about, as in the last testimony, about quick profits and this, that, and the other, that's not the bill that's before us. So welcome to the committee. State your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Dill. My name is Dean Flugstad. I'm from Lake City, Minnesota. I'm an unpaid volunteer for Hiawatha Trout Unlimited as a Boots in the Water Habitat Improvement Planner and Installer. Our 500 members have for over 35 years raised hundreds of thousands of dollars and spent thousands of hours in cooperation with the DNR on projects to stabilize banks, to prevent erosion, to create homes for non-game species while improving habitat for three species of trout in our 208 streams and rivers in southeast Minnesota. These are economic drivers for southeast Minnesota, as witnessed by my visit in Trout Run last year
with two fishermen from Bismarck, North Dakota, who, when I asked if they had friends and relatives in Minnesota, I was surprised to hear that they were there just to fish and enjoy the area. Rather remarkable, since Bismarck is as close to the fishing mecca of Billings, Montana, as it is to Lanesboro. For the sake of brevity, I'll say my key issues are water quality and quantity and prevention of sand spills by a correct mine locating and proper construction and maintenance of such. Do we really know the effects of pumping millions of gallons of water per day by the mines will have on underground aquifers and springs feeding our rivers and streams? I have spent many months with the Lake Township and the Wabasha Planning Commission trying to determine the best set of regulations to include an ordinance for this unique area, unique to southeast Minnesota's karst geology. House File 906 would be very helpful to us. I think Mark Twain said it best when he said, "Whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting over." I, for one, plan on fighting for water. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flugstad. Next on the agenda, we have Mr. Bobby King. If you could come down, please, and introduce yourself. Thank you, Mr. King, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Most of what I wanted to cover has been brought up, so I'll make this quick. I just wanted to add that, you know, as we've heard, this is a really new industry for Minnesota, and we've seen how it's not working in Wisconsin. And it's been, for the most part, dumped on local governments. And they're doing what they can through their zoning powers to try to deal with it, and many are doing the best job they can. But I've got a letter here. It's signed by 28 locally elected officials, county commissioners, city council people, township officers, that I'd like to distribute to the committee members, asking for the state to take action on this. And they're asking really for three things, and the House File 906 addresses much of it, and Land Stewardship Project supports House File 906. They want better information from the state in making local decisions and in how the industry will impact the region. And the second point on the letter is they do want strong state permitting standards that work with local control. And in LSP's experience, what's happening is very similar to the feedlot industry when large feedlots moved into Minnesota. We didn't have state standards to deal with them that were adequate. Local governments struggled. Eventually, we created some better state standards. So local governments, a lot of them are asking for stronger state permitting standards to regulate pollution, and they will deal with and continue to deal with the land use issues through their local ordinances. So there'll be that overlay that works together. And lastly, these local officials are asking for a moratorium while those state standards are being figured out. I should say a moratorium on new and expanding facilities while those state standards are being figured out and while more information is gathered to help local governments make better decisions.
Any questions of the testifier? There being none, thank you very much. Beth Brocker.
Hello, I'm Dr. Beth Proctor. I am an educator. I'm a water quality expert. I freely give of my services, and I have been an expert witness for Blue Earth County as well. Thank you, Chairman Dill and members, for hearing me today. I come today with the concerns of more than 250 people that live in Lyme Township, Blue Earth County, Minnesota. We are along the Minnesota River. We're right outside of Mankato. And as you know, there is a boom in the industry. And right now, literally thousands of acres along the Minnesota River are in the process of being reviewed for silica sand mining. Most of this mining will take place in our aquifer, the Jordan Aquifer. I have a map. It looks like this. My handout looks like this. It should be in your packet. I would like to share with you answers to questions I asked the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. This dealt with the mining of silica sand in our drinking water, what amount of an aquifer surface area can be mined? To what depth can an aquifer be mined? What type of fill material can be used in an aquifer? I put these together because the answer is the same. Minnesota Department of Natural Resources answer, there is no statewide regulations. If a grandfathered quarry is using a wet mining technique, meaning they're not dewatering, does the DNR or any state agency have control over the operation? The DNR's answer, typically no. Are there any rules on the blasting in our drinking water aquifers? DNR's answer, this is regulated by the local government. There are statewide standards for taconite mining, but there isn't anything required for sand mining. Does any agency attempt to determine the changes that will take place in our drinking water aquifer after all of this is said and done? The Minnesota DNR's answer, there is some interest in getting a better understanding of groundwater quantity, but nothing has been done to develop a statewide standard. I also have in here some responses from the Minnesota Department of Health. I'll let you read them. But this situation is just plain scary. People that live in the areas that are impacted would like to see something besides there are no statewide regulations or nothing has been done on a statewide basis. We are a firm believer in township rights. Responsibilities do fall to the local government. And I applaud you for this bill that has the silica sand technical assistance team. It's absolutely outstanding. When I testified before the Senate, I asked for such a group. The state of Minnesota needs to strengthen its regulations and provide as much support as possible to local governments. This will take time, and silica sand is not going to go anywhere. I'm asking you please to consider taking the time to do it right. I thank you for your consideration and your service to the people of Minnesota.
Any questions for the testifier? There being none, thank you. Vicki Jackheiser.
Thank you, Chair Dill, and the House Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee for your time today. My name is Victoria Jaskerski, and I am a concerned citizen from Wabasha, Minnesota, a town of 2,500 on the Mississippi River. Wabasha is located on a scenic byway and part of the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge. Tourism, which includes people with kids in the car, bicycles on top of the car, and hauling a boat, is important to this area. We are known for a large population of bald eagles. The National Eagle Center, located in Wabasha, attracts well over 75,000 visitors a year. On the first weekend of SOAR with the Eagles at the beginning of March, 1,400 visitors came to Wabasha. These people come in cars, tour buses, recreation vehicles. I am sorry to say that Superior Sand Systems, in partnership with Canadian Pacific Railroad, was granted a conditional use permit for a transload facility in Wabasha at the end of December. A Rochester Post Bulletin article on October 12th stated that this project will more than double the number of heavy commercial trucks that cross the bridge between Wabasha and Wisconsin. As you heard earlier, the two main arteries to Wabasha are two-lane. Highway 61 is a two-lane highway where you are very often driving right next to the scenic bluffs. So the number of diesel trucks has been doubled amongst all the other types of transportation that people use. This transload facility will involve 560 diesel truck trips 5 days a week, and they only estimate providing about 50 jobs. Our medical center, which serves 16,000, employs about 450 people, and the medical instrument company about 160. Both have expressed concern that their ventilation systems may draw in fugitive silica dust, as the rail yard is only 3 blocks away. Both also expressed concern that their employees and patients may have difficulty getting to their facilities due to increased truck traffic. The towns along the river are in a valley between the ancient bluffs. Air concerns may linger longer due to the valley formations. I have attended quite a few county and city meetings in the past year. The MPCA gave presentations. MnDOT was consulted. We already have technical organizations who will present what information they have. But the information they have does not address this new mining endeavor. This mining is not business as usual. I've heard from testimony from the mining companies how silica sand is in everything. Mirrors and ceramic mugs have been around for quite a while, but the amount of silica sand in them did not generate the proposed increase in truck hauling or the mining needed to fill those trucks. We need projected information in the form of an actual study and time to understand the results of such study, especially regarding cumulative effects of diesel exhaust and fugitive dust. Thank you.
Any questions for the testifier? There being none. Thank you. Sarah Miles.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornish.
I got a question for you. No, not to put you on the spot or anything, but
go ahead.
You come from an area where there's a lot of mining going on, and I think you probably wish there was more. Do you have any bald eagles left or any tourism, or has that been wiped out by the mining?
Representative Cornish, we have Voyageurs National Park in the Boundary Waters Canoe area, in the very near proximity of the, as well as the North Shore, Giants Ridge, and other tourist attractions in and around the mining area, the iron ore formation on the Mesabi. Sarah Miles, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Miles, and I am a citizen of Winona County. I received my degree through the Geography Department at UW-La Crosse, and I believe it's important for you to understand the unique geological formation that is the Driftless area. About 540 million years ago, the Paleozoic era began. At this time, there was no terrestrial life on Earth. But the world's oceans teemed with invertebrate forms of life, and their skeletal remains littered the ocean floor for millennia. Tectonic upheaval led to the ocean floor becoming dry land in parts of the supercontinent Pangaea. If you fast forward to the glacial periods of North America that occurred approximately every 40,000 to 100,000 years for the past 2.5 million years, these episodes of glacier formation exerted tremendous pressure upon the land. Marvelously, however, one area in central North America was repeatedly skipped over by every one of these periods of glaciation. This left the entire parcel we know as the Driftless Area, contained mostly in the states of Wisconsin and Minnesota, unflattened by the drifting ice sheet. Therefore, unlike the surrounding physical geography, which is merely about 10,000 years old, the Driftless Area is an example of a truly ancient landscape, and it has bedrock which has been eroded upon for over half a billion years. There's nothing like it on Earth. In addition to the familiar hills and bluffs of the region, the karst landscape boasts such features as cave systems, underground streams, sinkholes, springs, and cold streams. On ridge tops and dry slopes grew tall grass prairie, as well as bur oak savanna, now an incredibly rare habitat. What prairies and marshes took hold in the valley floors, while sugar maple and basswood forests thrived on the north-facing slopes. There's a great diversity of ecosystems in this area. On the upper reaches of south-oriented slopes developed a unique dry ecosystem called a goat prairie. On some northerly hillsides are found algific talus slopes, which where the endangered Iowa Pleistocene snail and the threatened plant northern monk's hood, which is rarely found anywhere outside the driftless area, make their home, as do many species of concern throughout the driftless area. As a child, I climbed to the top of the hill that overlooks the Century Farm, where my Norwegian ancestors settled and my parents still live today. I stood on that rocky outcropping of the treeless opening in the woods that I would later learn is called a goat prairie. I felt the unhindered wind blow all around me, and I felt the sun warm my face. It was the first time I felt the freedom and oneness of the universe with me a part of it. My ancestral farm is in Trempealeau County, now host to more frac sand mines than any other in the driftless area. I don't know yet if this short-sighted industry will devour my homeland in its ceaseless greed. I don't know if those universal awesome powers of wind and sun that I so intimately experienced that day will be utilized in time to steer our society towards sustainable energy and away from the detrimental frivolous practices. I do know that when I leave here today, I will continue working on my business plan. It is a plan that could employ several full-time and several seasonal staff members on a sustainably run farm that encourages its clientele to learn more about the land we grow our food in and our various roles in maintaining a healthy balance. I hope that this type of local-minded economy has a place in southeast Minnesota for a long time coming, and that those elected to protect the sovereign rights of the people, not the corporation, will act accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? There being none. Vince Reedy.
My name is Vince Reddy. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for hearing us today. My name is Vince Reddy. I live in Saratoga Township, just south of St. Charles, Minnesota. It's a farming community. I raise cattle there. I'm a retired registered nurse. I've lived here for 35 years. I've seldom been to the Capitol before until this issue came up. I feel like it's a very important issue to us in my township. The issue of frac sand mining is so important that we've made the trip up here four times on our own time to speak to legislators about what's going on. The township where I live is a proposed site of seven sand mines in an area about 2 miles by 5 miles. The first three mine proposals would comprise 130 acres. Each of those mines would generate 600 truck trips a day. It's an area 2 miles by 5 miles adjacent to my farm. That's 1,800 truck trips a day for the first three. There are seven mines being proposed. Each mine would involve blasting numerous pieces of earth-moving equipment, lighting, sifting, sorting from 6 a.m. until 10 p.m. year-round, and the company estimates a minimum of a 20-year supply of silica sand. These mine proposals by various concerns, but mostly it's by Minnesota Proppant. They're in addition to a washing plant proposal near St. Charles that we found out last night we may have conquered. But about 2 weeks ago, I drove a journalist around our township, and we toured all of the proposed mine areas. I gave him a plat map with an outline of every mine. We passed three other vehicles during a two-hour trip in my township. And now we're looking at a little bit different environment once all of the traffic starts up. We drove past dozens of Amish and English farms. About a third of my township is Amish. We drove past cattle, horse farms, hundreds of acres of productive cropland, and the families that live here. We live in a safe, healthy, productive environment. If the proposed mines start their enterprise here, our environment and our atmosphere and our resources are changed forever. Our safe, scenic farming community, It's going to become a heavily industrialized area. I visited personally the mine sites in Wisconsin. I've seen how the actual practice of silica production is working, and I'm very concerned about our water quality, our water quantity, our air quality, related both to diesel traffic and particulate silica, respirable silica dust. The tremendous traffic activity and equipment noise, it's going to cause a permanent change to our countryside. A vast majority of the people in our community have already signed a petition to arrest the progress of this industry. We want to see a wide support for House Files 906. We would like to see a statewide moratorium on this industry. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. E. Is there any questions for our testifier? Hearing none, thank you for coming to testify. Our next testifier coming down will be Mr. Fred Corrigan. Mr. Corrigan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Fred Corrigan. I'm Executive Director of the Aggregate and Ready Mix Association of Minnesota, a statewide association representing aggregate and ready mix producers. The Minnesota Industrial Sand Council is a council that has been created within our association to represent aggregate producers who are also involved in mining industrial sand. Our association has worked with the legislature since 1950 to clarify the regulation of the aggregates industry, including industrial sand. Most recently, the industry worked with the Legislative Aggregate Task Force for more than a year to produce a comprehensive report on the industry to the legislature in 2000 and to revise and increase the aggregate tax in 2000. We want to thank Representative Hansen for his willingness to work with our members in his work on this bill. I can't speak to Wisconsin, but many of the mining companies that are proposing industrial sand operations in Minnesota have been mining in some cases for generations. A number of these projects are expansions of mining properties that have been producing construction aggregates, quarry rock, sand, and yes, industrial sand for decades. These operators support the current permitting system that they have been involved in for decades. This process currently includes a combination of local zoning, ordinances, and CUP or IUP, as well as state agency review and permitting. In this process, there was a comment made earlier about traffic projections. This process, permitting process, does make those traffic projections, so we're not sure why people feel they don't see that information in the current process. We appreciate Representative Hansen's recognition of the potential impact on traditional aggregate operations already in operation and support DE3 and look forward to continuing to work with him. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Corrigan. Is there any questions for our testifier? Hearing none, our next testifier will be Mr. Petter Larson. Welcome, Mr. Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Peter Larson, Larkin Hoffman Law Firm. I'm here with the Minnesota Industrial Sand Council. And I've got a few things in your packet that I'm going to point out. One is the Minnesota Industrial Sand Council. In case you're wondering who we are, it's a group of companies that are longtime employers and companies in Minnesota. Two of them are going to come up after me. You can see the mission statement that's in here that the council was formed to promote safe, environmentally responsible sand mining and promoting fact-based discussions and working with local governments. I'll just leave that for you. There's also a list of friends of the industry, which includes not only people who work in the industry, but people who use silica sand, just to point out, for example, the Minnesota Metal Casters Association. So just in case anybody is still unclear about how this product is used, the metal casters use it a lot. They're a friend of our industry. So I think you've got this.
Excuse me, Mr. Larson. I was going to mention, I'm not finding it. Does
okay.
I don't.
We will get you a copy of this.
Okay. Thank you.
And I just wanted to talk quickly about the industry's point of view. We really appreciate Representative Hansen's work on this issue. We've appreciated lots of members weighing in on this. We don't want to in any way diminish the importance of these projects to neighbors. You're going to have some companies come up and hear that. You're going to hear them talk about how important it is for them to work with local governments and their neighbors. For example, one of the companies that are going to come up have been in their neighborhood for 126 years, and they certainly would never say to folks who want to come up and talk with you that they shouldn't be listened to. That's how these companies have been in business for as long as they have. Just quickly, we want to make sure, too, you understand that we support strong state standards. We support environmental review. It's appropriate at different levels for different sizes of facilities. Within our members, we've got a facility that's doing an EIS, a facility that's in the middle of an EAW, and a facility that got built without even an EAW. So we work at all levels of environmental review. We support that type of activity. We think it's very valuable for us to work with local governments by doing environmental review and sharing that information with communities. We do want to point out there's sometimes discussion about whether there's state standards that apply to us. You haven't had the benefit of the testimony that was in the Senate, but the PCA could come up here and talk to you about the air permits that we need, the water permits that we need, the stormwater permits that we need, lots of state standards in those. The DNR could come up and talk to you about water appropriation permits, about groundwater protection. The Department of Health is actually, and this was discussed some earlier, the Department of Health is setting a silica sand ambient air standard. In their comment letter on the Doblestein and Yoder EAWs, which is kind of well known, even though you might not know where that is, their comment was that it was important for a silica ambient silica standard to be established. They're working on it, and they said in their comment letter that they would have it done by mid-2013. So that's important for you to know. They are working on it. At least that was their public statement a month or so ago, that they would have it done by mid-2013. Our members are voluntarily monitoring silica sand outside a couple of the projects. Actually, one of our members in another facility that's not our member is actually monitoring silica off their site at their property boundary. That information is starting to come out right now. There are actually results from one facility. So we're actually working voluntarily with the PCA to collect that information, and we're happy to be doing that. We want to know what's coming off of our sites so we can understand if there's a standard established in Minnesota that we'll know what we're doing so we can do what we need to comply with it. The other thing that the Department of Health has recommended to the PCA, and this was in their comment letter as well, is there is a California ambient air silica standard. They recommended, and they state this in their letter, that the PCA use the California standard as a screening level standard until the Department of Health has established a state standard. So we just wanted to make sure that you understood that we're actually working with these agencies. We're collecting data, and we, as much as anything, businesses you might expect like clarity, we'd like a standard because then we'd know what we had to build to. Just a couple other comments. I think we did hand out this Office of LeSueur County Administrator letter. This is in your packet. This is directed to Senator Schmidt, so it's a little bit different bill. But I just have a couple things in your packet just to point out that there are local governments that are working well under their existing ordinances to permit facilities now. So this is a letter from LeSueur County just describing that they've got the ordinance authority that they have. They are permitting facilities. They're doing environmental review. The other thing I handed out, I think is in your materials as well, is the Wabasha County ordinance. This is a proposed ordinance, and you can see it's dated March 18th because that's their next meeting, and my understanding is they're going to adopt this ordinance then. And I won't go through the details with you, but if you look through this, you see a lot of setbacks, information on reclamation standards, things like that. So I just want to help you understand that the local governments actually are doing a lot, and this is you don't even have to read it as much as just look through how complete it is. So this is a non-metallic mining and processing ordinance, and then there's also the second green part is a reclamation ordinance. They have in here, by the way, setbacks and a reclamation standard and some bonding requirements for facilities. And then finally, I just wanted to point out to you the Scott County interim use permit that from May 1st of last year. And again, this is a county that has been in the Senate saying we really have had mining in our county for a long time. They've got an ordinance. They're issuing permits. And one provision I wanted to point out, This is an interim use permit, not a conditional use permit, meaning that it has to be renewed. So this isn't like a conditional use permit that lasts forever. So this permit actually has to be renewed. So if there's new standards that come up that need to be met, this permit can be reopened. And there's actually a provision in here that specifically said that it will be reviewed based on environmental review of nearby projects. So that's it, Mr. Chair. We're happy to be here. Again, we appreciate the work that Representative Hansen's done, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Larson? Representative Ackbarth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Larson, are you for the bill or are you against the bill? I mean, I heard a lot of stuff
Mr.
here.
Larson. Mr. Larson.
You like parts
Mr.
of this
Chair, joke? Representative Hackbarth, I think I'm going to be in the top 10 for the DNR and the PCA for their videos, too, because I'm saying so many good things about them. We think Representative Hansen has really got some good provisions in here. We think that particularly the language in here that allows local government to get help, that's what we hear mostly. We've been through a lot of hearings now. So we think that that's good information. We, to tell you the truth, would be... we think the DNR and the PCA, based on our experience, and MnDOT have a lot of expertise to help local governments, and so we think that that is helpful. So in general, we think Representative Hansen's doing a good job. We've got some things we'd like to work up with him on.
Further questions for Mr. Larson? Thank you, Mr. Larson. Next person up is from Jordan Sands. I don't need it.
Hi, my name is Bob Coughlin, and I'm a lifelong resident of Mankato, and my family has worked in the mines and quarries between Kasota and Mankato for 126 years.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Scott Sustacek, Chief Executive Officer of Jordan Sands. We appreciate the opportunity to be here tonight with you, even though the hour's running late, so we'll keep our comments succinct. We are developing a sand mine in the Mankato area, and as Bob mentioned, his family's been mining limestone in Mankato for 125 years. His grandfather put the limestone that you'll see over in the Capitol inside.
And the wainscot, the walls that surround the elevators here, outside here.
So. we also, Bob has also developed other businesses over the course of the years, Capstone Press. He employs 240 people in the state of Minnesota, 350 around the world. We own a limestone business that's been hit pretty hard through the recession. We've had to shed jobs there, unfortunately. The sand underneath the limestone in our existing quarries represents an opportunity for us to continue the life of those quarries and to also create good-paying jobs in the Mankato area. Greater Mankato area has been home to large-scale industrial sand mining for over 40 years. One of the largest sand mining companies in the world is located there. In fact, they just one of the letters that Peter was showing is about a permit that they received on a 1,000-acre parcel. Our project is a humble 70 acres, but it's in existing quarries that have already been through one environmental permitting process. Our plants are located in an industrial zone. We've gone through going through an EAW process that generated this stack of information. Bob's invested well into seven figures into this project to bring it forward. We have worked very closely through the years, and as Bob has in the limestone business, with our township board, with the Blue Earth County officials, state government, the city of Mankato, and going through this process, it's imperative to have those relationships, to work closely with the state, local officials, city officials. And we, in this bill, continue to believe that those communities and those townships, local governments that need the support from the state should get it. We believe in strong state control. And having gone through this process to the depth that we have, and continue to work with the PCA, the DNR, the Department of Health, that there are strong state processes out there today. And they are working. The 1,000-acre parcel that is was just permitted. The last time I checked in terms of sand mines coming forward in Minnesota, is still in excess. That one mine is in excess of all the other mines that are even in process permitting today in terms of total acreage. And so this state, I think, knows how, certain governments know how to permit large-scale sand. And the Minnesota River Valley is well known for that. And so we appreciate Representative Hansen's work on this bill and in bringing forth these technical committee to the group, and we would like to see that continue.
We support the...
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sustatek, Sustatek, sorry. You mentioned you work with your EAW, worked with MnDOT, Department of Health, MPCA, maybe Bowser. I don't know if you mentioned Bowser. Did you work with EQB?
EQB, the consultant I believe for Lyme Township had accessed EQB to get some direction from them on certain aspects of our EAW. And they don't necessarily provide specifics. They will provide some guidance.
McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just interested in what they do because they're actually a two-person agency, and
right,
they're in this bill to do a lot of things, and I can't imagine. You specifically mentioned the agencies that you should be working with.
Correct.
And you didn't mention EQB, and I'm wondering what involvement they've ever had with you in the past.
Mr. Chair, Representative, EQB, again, is more of an oversight and guidance body, to my understanding. As a proposer in this project, we did not have really direct involvement with them in any way, shape, or form. Our focus and input was from the state agencies mentioned.
Those agencies are represented on the EQB
board. And the EQB board, correct.
Further questions? All right.
Thank you.
Yes. One of the things I find interesting here in this committee at this time is that we have people testifying against sand mining, frack sand mining. We've got them testifying for it, but not. We had just some testimony about the benefit of the limestone, but not anybody said anything about the benefit of the sand and what it's used for and why it's needed. So I'm going to ask somebody to come up and explain that so you can get prepared. Mr. Bryan. Representative Boginius, do you have a question now?
I would like to have somebody from PCA come up after this, if that's
yes.
All right.
And also possibly the Department of Health as well, because there are some other questions. I don't know if someone in here is in here from the Department of Health. Mr. Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for listening to our testimony today. It sounds like I've been anointed the one to talk about the benefits of sand mining, so hopefully I can do so. My name is Matt Bryan. I'm the Vice President of Operations for Bryan Rock Products. We're a limestone mining company. We've been in operation, family-owned in the state of Minnesota for 72 years. I represent the fourth generation of Bryans to be involved with the company. We have three pit locations, Shakopee, Bayport, and Hastings. Shakopee's in Scott County, Hastings and Bayport are both in Washington County. We are currently proposing to do a mine in Scott County. It's a continuation of the limestone mining. As Scott talked about several years ago, the aggregates industry was hit very hard by the recession. And like them, the sand mining opportunity represented us to continue the limestone mining, expand our existing reserve. And the goal would be to have something available for possibly the fifth generation to operate. We work closely with our county and our township. We're currently slated, and we are doing an EIS at our project. In that EIS, we will be studying water impacts, vegetation, traffic, blasting, noise, air emissions, and there's reclamation. There's probably sections I've missed because there's so many. And during that time, we've had several meetings with the township and the county. And the county and the township have invited members of those state agencies to be included in those conversations while we're drafting the CIS, and have been included in these conversations. It's been very beneficial to the project, and we feel that the state agencies have a lot of input on the project as it stands. Also in Scott County, just recently last year, a sand mine has been permitted successfully, not too far from our site. And as Peter stated, they were given an IUP, an interim use permit, whereas the county can install different parts of that based on what our EIS or different regulations that change, such as air emissions. We have committed we have invested just under $2 million of this project in 2 years. And we feel like since the county, our county has successfully handled this, that they are the best and most equipped to handle our project.
Hey, Mr. Bryan, let's hear about a little benefit from the sand mine.
Well, we project, just on our project, we hope to create 50 to 70 jobs. You know, that's
not the kind of benefit I'm talking about. Everybody knows that when you open a mine, you have jobs. I want to hear about what you do with the stuff and what's the commercial applicability and all of those kinds of things. Thank you.
Well, just from this, industrial sand has been mined in the upper Midwest for centuries. They use it in glass making, fiber optic cables, abrasives, sandpaper, golf courses, sand traps, artificial glass, cement, mortar, foundries, countertops. Cambria uses it, water purification, radio and TV components. And those are a lot of the uses. Now, we're not making any bones that a lot of this is going to go towards oil and gas production, and that's a revolution that's taken hold just west of us, has been said. And you know, this is Minnesota's chance to be involved with that and create some jobs and create an industry around that without having to be directly involved with the drilling and the fracking process itself.
So I assume you, Mr. Larson, drove a car here and used gasoline to get here.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Larson.
Yes, I did. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I understand that this was actually now just passed out, Minnesota Industrial Sand Council, and what he was reading from was the bottom of that, so you have that list of uses here. And
well, thank you. I wanted to get some of that off the record. And I don't think, frankly, you should be shy to put oil and gas production at the top of the list. Okay. That is the end of the testifiers that we have on the list. Is anyone, Mr. Lincheski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Lincheski. I'm with Minnesota Trout Unlimited, and thank you for giving me an opportunity to address the amendment. I did the page is passing around some written comments I'd like added to the record, but I want to just really focus on the actual language of the amendment. I just want to start by saying, for us, the southeastern part of the state, called the Driftless Area, and it's on the back of this handout. There's a map showing the area that we are very concerned about because it is really a world-class fishery down there, very sensitive. It's a unique area. It also has silica sand to underlying it. So while many of the testifiers in the industry were talking about the great work they've been doing in the Minnesota River Valley, I'm focused just narrowly on the southeastern part, the Driftless Area. Again, extremely valuable. Fisheries drawing anglers from around the country now. And I just want to point out we're talking about public waters and public fisheries, and I think it's very important to keep in mind that I think it's appropriate for the state to do some minimum standards. So while the amendment talks about providing guidance to local units of governments, we'd like to see some reference to the fact that perhaps our state agencies could also take a look at their standards as a result of this process. So we recommend that. And again, our focus is on groundwater. It's the lifeblood of these streams, and so we're trying to protect the groundwater. We have a huge area here. Even in these six counties, we have about 4,000 square miles. The current North American demand for sand would require, you know, less than a square mile of that area be mined in any given year. So lots of opportunity here. We just would like to just kind of stay away from our groundwater in that area. So specific language changes, I have three I would suggest, or you know, at least draw your attention to. On line 2.13, there's a reference to setback from designated trout streams. To that, we would suggest that be added class 2A waters. Those are also trout streams. They just haven't been designated yet. And there are a number of excellent trout fisheries in the southeast that are will soon be reclassified as class 2A, even though they're not designated trout streams. They are, in fact, trout streams and have been for decades. So we'd like to see class 2A waters added to that, as well as perennial flowing tributaries. And then secondly, perhaps after line 2.16, add another subpart and looking, having them look at setbacks for springs and groundwater seepage areas. Because, again, groundwater is the lifeblood of these fisheries. That's what we're trying to protect. And we'd hope they would take a look at that as well. And then finally, the third possible change, it's on probably line 3.3, but again, trying to get in some language to indicate that maybe our state agencies would also be able to use the, you know, standards or guidance that comes of this process. So those are the three suggested improvements. We really thank Representative Hansen for this bill, and we strongly support it. And again, thank you for your
questions for Mr. Lincheski. There being none, thank you, John.
Thank you.
Further individuals here that would like to testify, come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jason George. I'm the Legislative and Political Director with the Operating Engineers, Local 49. I'll be brief. To your point, well, first of all, I want to thank Representative Hansen, too, for most of all, for what's not in this bill, which is a moratorium or a statewide generic GEIS, which we both will, we feel like both of those would inhibit job growth in the state. So I want to thank you for moving in a different direction. But to your point, Mr. Chair, about where the sand is going, we're not shy about talking about the oil and natural gas industry. We have thousands of members that work in that industry. And just so the committee knows, there's 3,000 Minnesotans, 3,000 49ers. They're in North Dakota right now, making very good money and bringing that money back home to Minnesota to feed their families. And that's where a lot of this product is going, and we think that's a good thing. Also, you know, just to lay out briefly what kind of jobs these are, I've heard a lot of some other folks talk about what kind of jobs these are. These are jobs that pay $40 plus an hour in rural Minnesota, with family health care provided by the employer, pensions provided by the employer. These are the best jobs you can find in rural Minnesota in most cases. As far as the local aspect of it, or jobs being imported, as I heard, that just simply isn't accurate. Every mining pit operator I've ever talked to lives within 30 miles of their pit. And that's very in stark contrast to the rest of the people in our industry who, like I said, are in North Dakota. They have to travel to get construction work. These jobs are the cream of the crop. You get to work close to home. And that's a huge benefit for families in this industry. So that's an important point to make. Why am I here, and why have I been testifying on the need for these jobs? Well, it's very simple. I don't know how many people are aware of this. Everybody's aware of the Great Recession, but in Minnesota, and with construction workers, we suffered a Great Depression. From 2005 to 2009, we lost 40,000 construction jobs in the state. Those are from Deed. From 2010 to 2011, we lost 12,000 construction jobs in that year alone, which ranked us dead last in the country. Now, the last couple years, this legislature and the governor have put many projects in the works, and things are getting, you know, a little bit better, but that recovery is very fragile for our members. We went from 13,000 members to 10,500 members. That's 2,500 highly skilled operating engineers, heavy equipment operators that vanished from the industry in this state. We want to bring them back home. And mining is a huge part of the construction industry. We're looking for support to get this going. We feel it's critical to the future for these families that work in this industry. And I really want to thank Representative Hansen again and the chair for bringing this bill forward. We see this as a way to move forward, as opposed to a moratorium or a GEIS statewide that is a way to stop the industry. So thank you again, Representative Hansen. We support your bill. We look forward to working with you in the future. Thanks for taking my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Questions for Mr. George? Okay, thank you. Anyone else in the audience that would wish to care? We have someone coming down. state your name for the record.
My name is P.D. Wells, and I'm a former mayor of the city of Jordan in Scott County. And I just like to come forward and say that you know, I've worked with Scott County for the last probably 4 years on some of the permitting that's been going on within Scott County, and I know that I've heard a lot about the model ordinances that they have done and stuff like that in Scott County. The problem with it is they carry a big stick, and that's where local control, being that the mines are outside the city limits of Jordan, it was always trouble as far as I was concerned, as far as negotiating with the cities versus the county, because basically the county has the permitting authority on the mines. So they've been working on some of those. They've done the data. Some of the questions that I've asked from them as far as when you're looking at the aquifers and we're looking at some of these mines that are they're going down hundreds and hundreds of feet deep, and they're going directly into the aquifer. And I'm not sure if I wish I had one here, but when you look at the geology for Scott County, the mines are going in the at-risk areas for the aquifer. And an example I've got is we have Sand Creek that runs right through the city of Jordan. Well, just on the south side, this river flows north into the Minnesota River. And on the south side, we actually have what they consider a Class 2 rapids, where the kayakers will come and run their kayaks and stuff. When you get to the north side, and this is where most of these mining operations are going, it's a losing creek, so the water is literally flowing into the ground. And we're stripping away all the protective covering from that, and it's essentially going to end up directly in our aquifer. Now, this Sand Creek is also highly polluted because we have a lot of nitrates coming off farm fields, a lot of development out there. So this issue is something that I look at that's dear to my heart, and I look at, you know, we've got water supplies that need to be protected. So I'm going to just kind of go back over how much water. This is the question I asked the county, how much water can we safely pollute? I think we need to look at that as a state and as a country. We talk about it, about phosphorus runoff. We want to protect that. But all of this stuff is going to go directly into the aquifer. So that's one of the things I'd just like you guys to consider. Thank you very much.
Two questions for the testifier. There being none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Further testimony. Anyone else that would like to testify for or against the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
I don't, and I apologize for having multiple bills up in other committees, but I'm unaware if the state agencies or the QB had testified.
Yes. In fact, what we're going to do, Representative Hansen, is we're going to have Mr. Colley from the Health Department, Mr. Fredrickson from the EQB, who's the EQB chair, someone from the PCA, and someone from the DNR, if we have someone from the DNR. And we're going to have a short panel of technical people, that is what may well end up being in the functions of the technical advisory assistants in this bill. Maybe not exactly, but I think you get the idea what I'm talking about. And we'll have a brief question-answer session about all the testimony we've heard or questions about the bill, how it's written and how it might affect and how the agencies might interact. And don't be bashful if we have a question for you. If it fits you better, raise your hand. We'll recognize you. So we'll start with the first question. First off, would each of you identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chairman.
Question. First off, would each of you identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chairman, my name is David Thornton with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Mr. Chair, members, Jess Richards, Director of Lands and Minerals with the Department of Natural Resources.
Mr. Chairman, Greta Gauthier, Director of Government Relations, Department of Agriculture, and the Commissioner of Agriculture is the Chair of the Environmental Quality Board.
Matthew Colley, Minnesota Department of Health.
All right. Now, if you can, members, when you have a question, direct it to a specific individual unless somebody wants to catch the ball, raise your hand up at the testifying table. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is difficult because we have air quality from PCA, and I think I'm asking a water quality issue. Well, I know I am. We have done the state taxpayers have spent a lot of money doing a TMDL for Lake Pepin. And one of the things that we have found is there is a lot of sediment in Lake Pepin. It continues to come, and we know that Lake Pepin is going to clog up unless we do something about it. Do you have in your toolbox the things necessary to make sure that this industry doesn't add to that problem?
Mr. Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruginius, you're right. It's a water quality question. I'll try to answer it, and then I'll have to go back and see if I messed up a little bit. I think we do. Most of these sites are required to have an industrial stormwater permit, and the purposes of those permits are to prevent runoff from the site. And there are some reclamation requirements associated with that small part of the operation. If they use large amounts of water, they are likely to be required to have a water discharge permit. And through those, we would be regulating the quality of the water and suspended solids and that sort of thing.
If I could follow
Representative Bogini has follow up.
Thank you. Well, that might be okay for the kind of common everyday day, but we have seen huge floods in this region, and we have heard from Dr. Mark Seeley that we can expect bigger and bigger weather events. So how would a weather event going through this area with this new industry affect the Lake Pepin TMDL, or Lake Pepin and the TMDL?
That be Mr. Thornton?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Reganius, I'm not sure I have a good answer for that. I would suspect that it would create some problems. And that's an example of the kind of things that we're starting to look at as we learn how the weather events are going to be different in the future. So that's something I'll have to go back and talk with other staff about.
Representative Guineas.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is one of the fundamental questions, because we can permit individual things, but without somebody looking at the big picture and saying, what's a big storm going to do in this area? Because I don't remember the exact amount we spent in this area on floods, but it was in the tens of millions of dollars, and we know that the potential for that is just sitting there right again. So I think one of the things we've got to think about is how we deal with these huge weather events in this area when we've opened it up. And I think that's something that's got to be incorporated into this bill thinking.
Questions from the members of this highly esteemed panel? Representative McNamara.
Well, I wouldn't be from the highly esteemed part. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's interesting. I understand you all serve on the board, or you represent your people that serve on the board, but actually the EQB director, I think, is sitting behind you, and if I'm not mistaken, he's one of only two employees at EQB, and I am just trying to understand why we don't have the people that are sitting there in control of this, because you're the people that have the knowledge. I mean, the fact that you're the ones in the front row right now, you've got the Department of Health, the Department of Ag, the DNR, the MPCA, and the only one I would say you don't have Director from Bowser there, potentially, or MnDOT. Those are the agencies that have the expertise in this state, the number of the employees, and who do work on these issues. And we are so close here with Representative Hansen's bill, but he's got the EQB on there, and I don't understand that at all. And I'd like to ask Director Patton, I'd like to understand, you are a two-employee agency. How in the world are you going to deal with this issue? Why not let the agencies here deal with it? I want to hear what you have to say. You're the director of this agency. Or, you know, it's maybe I'm wrong. It's not called an agency. It's I don't know what it is.
It's a board.
Hello. For the record,
yes,
and, welcome.
I am Bob Patton. I'm executive director of the Environmental Quality Board. Actually, I am an employee of the Department of Agriculture. I've been essentially on loan from the Department of Agriculture to the board for the last 3.5 years. We actually have the board actually has two full-time employees. They're housed at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, or the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is the host of the board. Really, the answer, part of the answer to your question is, Representative, is that the board is and has really always been, since it was formed in 1973, an entity to look at issues that cross agency lines, and a lot of the way the board has worked regardless of its staffing levels, has been to convene experts of the other agencies and work on issues that cross these agency lines, because a lot of these issues are interrelated. The other big function of the board is to provide expertise. The board writes the rules for environmental review, and so the other part of the role that I heard referred to tonight has to do with providing advice to responsible governmental units that do the environmental review, such as local governments in the case of silica sand. That's a lot of the time our staff spends, and our board meeting coming up next week is going to be dealing with some environmental review issues having to do with silica sand. So I guess that's part of the answer to your question, I believe.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Patton, listen to what you're saying. Our employees, correct me if I'm wrong, the EQB doesn't comment on those. It's MPCA or the DNR or the Department of Health. This bill is so close, Mr. Chair. If we could work with the agencies that can best help the locals, that's what we should be doing. We don't need to create another layer of bureaucracy to get in the way of doing the right thing. This should be done with the agencies that were there. And we're going to offer an amendment in a minute, I think, that'll fix that.
Further question, Mr. Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, since the EQB budget is within the PCA's budget, I'll just mention a couple of things. Like Mr. Patton said, the thinking that we've had on this recently is that this is a multi-jurisdictional issue, and local units of government who are currently the RGUs for these kinds of facilities have asked for help, and particularly in the environmental review and in developing best management practices, model ordinances or regulations, whichever you want to call it. And our thinking is that EQB would be a very good place for that coordination to happen. And it's my understanding that the governor's revised budget is going to provide some funding to make that happen within the EQB structure.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Thornton, I guess my question would be, if you're going to create another agency or add to the EQB in the governor's revised budget that we haven't seen yet, I assume that those people are going to have some expertise, but where are those people going to come from to come to the EQB?
Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, I think this, whether we do this or DNR does this or EQB does this, it's going to take resources, and we need to recognize that, and the different agencies will be supplying the kind of help that is needed for the EQB staff to pull all this together.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then going back to Representative McNamara's comment, it just seems to me that we're creating another layer of the bureaucracy to try and do these things that, I don't know, according to what we've heard from other testimonies from some of the other places where these gravel pits are already operating, it's already working. We've heard testimony that says that the permitting processes and so forth seem to be being successful at getting these projects up and running in a way that is protecting the environment, and I'm anxious to see the amendment.
Tim McNamara.
Well, Mr. Chair, water appropriation permits come from Mr. Richards' agency, the DNR. Air monitoring permits come from MPCA. Air standards are created by the Department of Health. Now we're going to create another bureaucracy for these poor township people to have to figure out how to jump through to get to you people. Let's let them work with you directly so they can do the right thing. We don't need to create another agency and another thing for them to jump through a hoop when they could work directly with you people, which they're already doing. And there clearly is a need for this. I don't understand why we want to now take an agency that really is just a board. I'm sorry, I keep calling it an agency. the EQB is just a board, and now we're going to start to have them get involved in all this. This is creating another layer of bureaucracy that the poor local, a township supervisor is the local farmer like Mr. Roddy, or it's a local guy that works at the hardware store, or it's different people, it's a contractor, different things they do for a living, and now we're going to, all of a sudden they got to deal with one more agency. I don't understand this. It does not make sense.
Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative McNamara. My boss, Department of Agriculture Commissioner Dave Fredrickson, chairs the current EQB, which is made up of 9 state agencies and 5 citizens. Over the summer, the EQB in July, August, actually into the fall, September, October, held about 13 hours of hearings taking testimony on the silica sand issue from all sides of the issue. And one of the commonalities that came forward throughout those hours of testimony was concern about how the cumulative impact of things would work, the cumulative impact on air quality, the cumulative impact on water quality. And so this bill, the commissioner, as chair of the EQB, feels that this bill puts the EQB in charge for good reason, and that is that when it was created in 73, the EQB was meant to look at cross-cutting, interdisciplinary, interjurisdictional, however you want to say it, issues that go beyond the scope of any one state agency and can mix together and create issues that perhaps are not even in the scope of any one of us directly, one of the agency member agencies. You have to remember also that DEED serves on the EQB and admin, MnDOT, DNR, PCA, agriculture, health, etc. So it allows for township boards, it would allow a much quicker access to a multitude of agency leadership to focus on something at the same time, and would save people from having to go from place to place to place to place because they're all right there at the EQB. So, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm just speaking in support of the EQB being the location for the committee that's being set up by Representative Hansen's bill. And the governor's budget does invest in EQB to handle and address multiple agency issues just like this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Hansen for spending all this time and getting this bill in order. My question is, looking at the Scott County report here and their interim use permit, which I like a lot because they can revoke at any time versus a conditional use permit, they went through Great Plains Sand, the Sand Creek Mine operation, a great deal of permitting process and everything else, groundwater surface monitoring and mitigation plan, fugitive dust control plan, blast monitoring plan, ambient air monitoring plan, photometric plan, geotechnical evaluation and plan, noise testing and mitigation plan, reclamation plan, and MnDOT applications too. Were you or any of your agencies involved with helping Scott County on putting together this comprehensive program?
To the panel.
Mr. Chairman, yes, we were. Many of us were.
And just looking at from the standpoint, Mr. Chair, the working metrics of things and everything else worked out very well with you working with the local county board putting together this very comprehensive plan, no problems, good information exchange, things like that?
Mr. Chairman, members, I think it worked pretty well. I think that there's that we need to draw a little distinction between a facility like Great Plains Sand or like Jordan Sand and some of the other facilities that have been proposed and that are operating. Great Plains Sand and Jordan Sand are all right there in one spot in an industrial
zoned area. They mine the sand there, they wash it, they dry it, they sort it, they load it on a train, and it gets shipped out from there with very little trucks involved and all on a contained site. And it's much easier for us and for a local government to get their arms around seeing that type of an operation. What we're seeing in southeastern Minnesota are mines all over the place shipping their sand by trucks to different processing places, and it's much more difficult to see the whole picture. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the, I think, one of the gaps that we've got. And when some of that is located in different counties and regulated by different counties, it makes it much more difficult to comprehensively look at and manage what's going on. And I think that's one of the challenges that we're facing here.
Mr. Chair, yes, I certainly understand that. I'm sure that no two facilities are alike, and there's challenges, lots of different challenges with scale and sites and everything else. But my point is, I thought this was a very, very comprehensive plan in a relatively early stage here, and I'm glad that all our state agencies could work together on that. One follow-up question, I guess piggybacking on Representative McNamara, was the Environmental Quality Board involved with the with this particular one?
Got you. Welcome again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, no, not directly. But I do want to say, though, that now Scott County is a relatively big organization. They have a good staff, and it's a relatively large staff compared to some of the other counties we're talking about. Even so, we regularly communicate with Scott County Environmental Services people on environmental review issues. And as a matter of fact, I had a phone call yesterday from the Environmental Services Director from Scott County. So not directly in that ordinance development. The agencies that have the expertise in transportation or pollution control and so forth, are water appropriations are better resources for that type of effort. But where I think the Representative Hansen's bill is bringing in the EQB is really as a convener and being able to pull together the expertise of multiple agencies on state level guidance, and I think the EQB is well suited to be able to do that.
Representative Buechel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll conclude here. Well, I looked at what Scott County did, and it is obvious that they have some resources because they did a wonderful job, I think, and I think that's a bit of a blueprint to prove that local counties and townships and things can get the job done, particularly with state help, which you guys did. I'm a big believer that in local control. I believe that that so many of the township boards and things really know what's going on, but they obviously do need your expertise. I think that we do need this mining. It does create jobs. There's wonderful opportunity here, not just from our state standpoint, but also from our national security and things. But it has to be done in an environmentally responsible manner. And we're not operating like we first did up on the Iron Range in the turn of the century. There are all these safeguards involved, and we almost take them for granted now. What the permitting process that you guys do as a matter of fact every day. So I'm confident that we can do this right. I share Representative McNamara's feelings about let's not create too much bureaucracy because we are dealing with local units of government. Scott County does have the resources, but other counties may not. So, you know, it's a balance point. It's where we can make it too tough for these guys. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, I believe, is Representative Arginius.
I'll pass now. Thanks.
I'll pass. Are there further questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the Department of Health. Mr. Colley, excuse me if I mispronounced it, but we had public testimony that was kind of conflicting from two different testifiers. One said that we have no silica sand ambient air standard, and no, I was led to believe no plan. But then I heard one of the other testifiers say that the department is close to developing a standard. And then will that standard be able to be used on, for instance, I understand there's one of the newer permits would potentially be subject to that standard, or is that not true?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, it's pronounced collie, like the dog breed. But to clear up the confusion on that, the Department of Health won't be setting standards surrounding ambient air quality. What we do is provide guidance. In this particular area, we provide health, I'm going to get the words wrong here, we provide health-based values at the request of either other state agencies, other programs within the Department of Health, or even citizens throughout the state. And we look at whatever is being asked for in this case, silica sand, look at the literature out there, try to find a level that poses little or no risk to human health, and then provide that guidance to those who requested it. In this particular instance, the MPCA, if I remember correctly, requested the Department of Health to look at silica sand and provide guidance to them that they may use for their processes.
Representative McNamara.
So just to clear up, I kind of used the plain language of a standard, but you said I really should have called it a health-based value.
Or that guidance.
Guidance that will be developed for little or no risk for the folks either working in the plant or the public farther out away from the plant?
We set, when we set values, that pose little or no risk to human health over a length of time, with specific focus on the fact that even subgroups or subpopulations such as pregnant women or children wouldn't be harmed. So what we're really going is down to the level where when we set this value or guidance that if it were to be used, it wouldn't matter who you were. It wouldn't pose a health risk to you over whatever time frame we set it at.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Colley, if I understand, you would use the assumption that it wasn't somebody necessarily as healthy as you. It may be a pregnant mother or a senior citizen or something potentially living there, and they may be affected more at a lower level potentially than a healthy adult, whatever. So you err on the conservative side is what you're trying to do.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
Thank you.
Further questions? There being none. I'm going to ask one more time. Thank you very much, folks. One more time. Anyone in the audience to testify for or against the bill as amended? There being none. Representative McNamara moves the 906DE1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment would be what is commonly been referred to as the Kelly bill. It's a duplication of Representative Kelly's bill. And the reality, this sounds a little bit redundant. And I want to say I really thank Representative Hansen for correcting a lot of the things in his bill already. But as we've had a pretty serious discussion in regards to the one big difference in Representative Hansen's bill, a significant one, there's kind of two things. One, he still has the EQB involved, and if you'll notice on the amendment I'm offering on lines 1.18 and 1.19, those folks that have been working on this issue and the ones with the expertise, the ones that set the health-based value or grant the water appropriation permit or regulate the road traffic, or set the ambient air quality requirements, are the ones that Representative Kelly and I am suggesting be part of this group that we're calling the Silica Sand Technical Advisory Council. And I understand, Mr. Chair, we are kind of getting down to the nitty-gritty here. We are getting very close on where I'm hopeful we can get. The one other substantial difference, I would say, we heard the local units of government talk about whether it would be the state coming in and telling them they have to do something, even though they feel they've done what they need to do. I changed that on line 2.23, where it says a local unit of government may request the advisory council provide them assistance. We've heard from a number of local units of governments that would like to have some assistance. This would set up an opportunity for them to do that. I think those are the two big differences between Representative Hansen's bill and my amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I would oppose the McNamara Amendment, and here are some reasons why. I think that the Environmental Quality Board is very important in this, particularly for the issue. I was here for enough of the testimony where Representative McNamara was talking about forming another layer of government. Well, this McNamara Amendment actually does create another advisory council, whereas the EQB already exists. Working with agencies, you have agencies that are equal to each other. Whether you go to the DNR or the PCA or the Board of Water and Soil Resources, Health Department, Department of Transportation, the EQB is the one-stop shop that I think will help local governments where they can go to and make those connections when they're asking for assistance. The technical advisory teams, local units of government are asking for assistance. And rather than having them shop through each of the agencies, they can make that contact with the Environmental Quality Board. The Environmental Quality Board has existed and does exist and has the ability to bring those agencies together. I have committed, and I'll commit here again, that I know the concerns that are raised with even the House File 906 as it has been amended. There are changes that we can make, specifically looking at the setback. I think there's some different ways of describing that. I am open to working with anybody to try to improve the bill between here and government operations, where a number of these local government operation issues, I think that is the appropriate committee to work on them. I appreciate the effort of Representative Kelly and Representative McNamara. I appreciate your questions on this. And I think we can move forward, but I don't think the amendment is the way to do that. And if we were going to proceed with the amendment, I would ask for a roll call.
And Representative Hansen, I have a question for the record. I asked the same question last night of Representative Wagenius. Do you believe that this bill, as amended, will have any impact of any kind on hard rock mining in Senate District 3, 4, 5, and 6? And if you don't, if it does, I'm tabling the bill. So you know what the answer must be.
Mr. Chair, it does not have any impact. And specifically, I made, and I think I might have left the bill in the other room, but I put in specifically, when you look at the definition of silica sand, that it does not include the silica compounds that are a byproduct of metallic mining. So I don't have that right in front of me, but if you look on the DE3, and that was specifically to make sure that there was the comfort there that I'm not talking about up north.
Okay, well, that's the reason I asked the question, because for those who don't know, when you mine doing hard rock mining up there, a couple percent at minimum is silica in the rock, it's contained in the rock. So that's the reason I just wanted to make sure of that. All right, so questions of... Actually, I'm going to ask if anyone has any questions of Representative McNamara on his amendment. Mr. Representative Fisher.
I do a little bit. From what I was hearing from Representative McNamara, he said that it was basically the same things but in his amendment. But as I'm taking a look at it, there's some things that I noticed that kind of got dropped out of his amendment that raised some concern for me. Some of it is initially in the initial definitions area. We talk about mining, we talk about processing, temporary storage, transportation, which is in the current amendment that is dropped from Representative McNamara's. And then when I go down further into the standards and criteria under subsection 2, one of the things that I noticed that was dropped out of there is under subsection 2.3, that's on Representative Hansen's. I see a reference to applicable groundwater and surface water appropriation permit requirements. That's been dropped out, and to me, that's a big concern. And then down under points 10 and 11 on Representative Hansen's, if I'm looking right, I'm noticing that points 10 and 11 are also dropped out there, which raises some concerns for me.
All right. Again, one more time. Representative McNamara, do you have any comment to the Representative Fisher?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would say most of those would be normally covered in the permitting process. I mean, Representative Hansen has put a bunch in with blanks on them, but they would normally be covered in the permitting process is what I would say. And again, I think as this moves forward, if some of those are important to be in there, I think Representative Hansen will be amenable to putting those back in.
Further questions? So we have the DE1 amendment, the 906 DE1 amendment, and Representative Hansen, have you requested a roll call?
Yes, I have, and encourage you to.
Representative McNamara.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to actually pull the amendment because Representative Hansen and Representative Kelly are both continuing to work on this issue, and they would like to continue to do that. I just think it's really important. We're so close here. I just don't think create more bureaucracy for our local units of government to have to go through as we go forward at this time would not be a good idea. So
okay,
at this point, I would withdraw the amendment.
Representative McNamara withdraws the DE1 amendment, and that makes Representative Hansen motion for a roll call not effective. Any further testimony on the bill?
Chair, I'm going to ask for a roll call on the bill unless you want to move it. I could if you'll move it to GovOps without recommendation, I'm okay with that. But if we want to move it with a recommendation, I'm going to ask for a roll call.
Representative McNamara requests a roll call. So now Representative Hansen moves the 906, House File 906 as amended. The clerk will take the roll.
Yeah. Representative Dale?
Pass.
Representative Fisher?
Yes.
Representative Benson?
Yes.
Representative Cornish?
No.
Representative Fabian?
No.
Representative Green?
No.
Representative Hackbarth?
No.
Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Isaacson?
Yes.
Representative McNamara?
No.
Representative Purcell?
Aye.
Representative Uglem?
No.
Representative Wagenius?
Yes.
Representative Ward?
Yes.
Representative Urusso?
Yes.
The bill is adopted on a vote of 8-6. The meeting is adjourned.